Honorable members, you are welcome, and in particular, let's welcome Judge Van Westhuizen and leaders of other stakeholder organizations that are here today. Our lines are down, so we didn't print out any documents, but we will circulate the attendance register that must be signed and returned to the committee secretary. So, as you know, the meeting is organized to allow stakeholders to make their inputs for our consideration. So, what we will do is we will take three at a time and then enter into a discussion, if you so please. And that would be Lawyers for Human Rights. And it's interesting that one of the co-founders of Lawyers for Human Rights is Judge Van der Westhuizen. So he's here in another life, but he laid a firm foundation for our human rights culture before the Constitution was adopted. And then we have the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative and LICRO. Can we call on Lawyers for Human Rights to start?
Morning, and thank you, Chairperson. By way of introduction, my name is Claire Ballard. I'm an attorney at Lawyers for Human Rights, and I run a program called the Penal Reform Project. The deficiencies in the legislative establishment of the judicial inspection have been canvassed extensively before this committee, particularly during the years 2011 to 2013, but arguably for more than 5 years this has been a topic of discussion, an intense discussion. This process of engagement, sadly, we think, despite rigorous encouragement on the part of stakeholders, mostly the ones that are before you today, did not yield any tangible results in the form of legislative reform. This is particularly disappointing given the wide range that this parliament, wide range of powers that this parliament has. All the more so since they are, it's bound by the Constitution to in fact remedy constitutional deficiencies, of which the legislative establishment of the judicial inspectorate is replete. And I must then sort of conclude this introduction by saying that we are somewhat disappointed that time and time again this process has stalled in its tracks. Accordingly, the purpose of these submissions is not to repeat what has already been said for over 5 years now, but it is rather to express and to notify the committee that LHR representing Sonke Gender Justice will soon, this term, this court term, be filing an application challenging the legislative establishment's objects on the grounds that it is unconstitutional. The application will explore the arguments that have been presented before this committee numerous times before, and these briefly are as follows. The notion of independent oversight is based on the premise that transparency and accountability are key features in a democracy, requiring that the exercise of executive power be checked by an organ or body which is direct, distinct from and independent of it. We cannot argue that the judicial inspectorate at least purports to be a body of this nature. And in many ways, it's just another Chapter 9 institution, although not expressly described as such in the Constitution. It's monitoring obligations are almost identical. The obligation on the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the Bill of Rights inevitably gives rise to a duty to establish and maintain an efficient prison oversight mechanism in order to secure accountability of the department for the proper treatment of inmates. Oversight measures must be reasonable and effective. A recent court case made this abundantly clear, and that's the one of Glenister. And in many ways, the application we will be filing will emulate the trajectory that that case followed. It expressly raised the importance of international norms and the way that they inform this responsibility, the Section 72 responsibility. Certainly the prison sector is no exception, for there are many international standards and norms informing the obligation. the Ouagadougou declarations, the Robben Island declarations, the Paris principles, and more recently, and perhaps importantly, the Mandela rules, which were finalized here in Cape Town. The optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture is also a persuasive example of what independent oversight looks like, and that protocol itself makes it very clear that independence is a fundamental part of any oversight body. Although we haven't ratified that document, we certainly have signed it, indicating our intent to ratify. So to the extent that the state has failed to ensure such measures, such failure violates a number of fundamental rights, including the rights to dignity, life, to be free from ill treatment and torture, and to be detained in conditions of detention consistent with human dignity. And the nub of what we want to say here is that independent oversight is really about the protection of rights. International law, again, makes this very clear. We signed and ratified a document called the United Nations Convention Against Torture. That document, again, explicitly mentions oversight. And the various commentaries and special rapporteurs that have interpreted that document, again, have made it very clear that oversight must exist in order to prevent and combat torture, and oversight must necessarily come from an independent organization. Our courts have given a lot more flesh to what independence means. Essentially, it means operational, financial, and administrative independence. The judicial inspectorate has a very limited degree of all these three concerns. Essentially, the state has failed to ensure that such measures on the grounds that the judicial inspectorate is inherently lacking the necessary institutional independence. So although the inspectorate is described in Section 85(1) as an independent office under the control of the inspecting judge, the location of JICS within the ICCV system within DCS, with close financial and administrative links between the two, undermines the actual and perceived independence of the inspectorate. In terms of Section 95 of the Act, the inspectorate is totally dependent on the department for its funding, and under Section 88, the CEO of JICS is accountable to the commissioner for all monies received by the inspectorate. This statutory scheme creates the risk that DCS could limit the funding made available to the inspectorate. And of course, as long as that risk is there, independence will always be compromised. The lack of financial independence from DCS is not of theoretical concern only. It has, in fact, impacted negatively on the ability of the inspectorate to function effectively by rendering it undercapacitated due to a lack of funds required to fill essential posts. The JICS annual reports are replete with examples. I have listed them there from paragraphs 25 onwards. There are several pages worth of forwards from the CEO and the judicial, whoever was the judicial inspector at the time, detailing their frustration at having requested monies from the department for things like office space, IT, technical support, but more importantly, full-time employees. The post-establishment concerns with JICS have been ongoing for many, many years and are directly connected to its inability to carry out its obligations effectively. We've also tracked the recommendations on the part of JICS through their quarterly reports, and it makes for dismal reading. There are, in almost 90% of cases, DCS simply just doesn't respond. And those are serious concerns. They're concerns of assault, torture, inhumane treatment, and precisely the types of concerns that the judicial inspectorate is concerned with and mandated to remedy. DCS simply ignores these. The purpose of the litigation that we intend to bring, challenging this, the legislative establishment, is born mainly out of frustration. It's not born out of a sort of inclination to fight the issue, but rather to prompt further engagement on this. In many ways, like the Glenister decision did, it's following a declaration of constitutional invalidity. It once again gives Parliament time and space to reconsider what a constitutionally compliant oversight body looks like. Again, we've brought many examples of what best practice models, international best practice models, look like to this committee. Those documents remain valid. The examples remain pertinent and relevant. There are many, many, many sort of models, examples from other jurisdictions of what good oversight models look like. And it's been very, a very frustrating and disappointing exercise for the stakeholders here today to have these processes stalled. I'm going to stop there and invite any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Lucas Minton. I head up the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative, which is a project of the Dalla Omar Institute at the University of the Western Cape. I'll start our submission with making a few introductory remarks and then hand over to my colleague, Gwenda Raymaker, who's sitting two down from me, and she'll deal with a couple of the substantive issues. The Constitution requires the establishment of an independent oversight body in respect of the police, but it does not do so in respect of the prison service. And I think that is a shortcoming, but that could be addressed through law reform. And we urge and we support such a process. In terms of history, the inspectorate became operational in around about 2001, and 3 years into its existence, we conducted two evaluations of the inspectorate's functioning, of the institution itself, and also of the Independent Prison Visitors Scheme, as it was named then. So in their recommendations were already made dealing with the independence of the inspectorate. 2 years after that, the Jali Commission released its report. Again, the Jali Commission was very unhappy about the independence and functionality of the inspectorate and made numerous recommendations. Unfortunately, none of those were followed up on. In 2013, we submitted, at the request of the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services, a fairly detailed report on the inspectorate. And it is my assessment that there was some momentum at the time with that committee to engage in a reform process, but somehow that also was lost. But there's been sustained pressure and engagement on the issue of the inspectorate since then, as Claire has already mentioned. And the central issue for us is from a human rights perspective, and it deals specifically with a culture of de facto impunity in law enforcement in South Africa, and with particular reference to the police and the Department of Correctional Services. It's indeed a very rare occasion that serious violations are properly investigated and that prosecutions follow from that. So from our side, we really urge the committee to prioritize the reform of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services so that we have an institution that is effective and independent and is able to address rights violations in the department. I hand over to Gwen.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So as Lucas mentioned, this issue, and as Claire mentioned as well, this issue has been examined by this committee on numerous occasions, but I don't believe it has been examined under this in this committee, at least not since the committee, since the Department of Justice and Correctional Services merged. And Claire has briefly touched upon the two major issues in relation to the lack of independence of the judicial inspectorates, but I'll briefly go through them again just in case some members of Parliament present are not well versed with the challenges around the independence or the lack of independence of the inspectorate. So the issues are mainly twofold: a lack of financial independence and a lack of administrative independence. And then that raises the issue of the legal mandate and powers of the inspectorate, which I'll address last. So the lack of financial independence, as Claire mentioned, Section 91. That the DCS is responsible for JICSA's funding, and therefore it controls the entire operations of the inspectorate. Yesterday, Mr. Masondo confirmed that it's suffers from a lack of funding, but that it cannot do anything without DCS approving more funding for its operations. And the CEO, Mr. Massandri, is also financially accountable to the to DCS. On the lack of administrative independence, the CEO is appointed by the minister, and as Claire mentioned, Jigsaw staff, and as Mr. Masondo mentioned yesterday, Jigsaw staff is part of the DCS staff establishment. So even if it does, in 2013, it did receive more funding to hire more staff, but because Treasury decides on the DCS staff establishment, it wasn't able to hire more staff. The issue of administrative independence was already highlighted in the JAL report more than 10 years ago, and it hasn't been addressed since. But the independence must not only be effective, but it must also be perceived to be independent. And what has become quite obvious over the years is that prisoners don't perceive the judicial inspectors, or at least not the ICCVs with whom they have contact on a regular basis, to be independent from DCS. And so that mechanism, we can question whether that mechanism still has its legitimacy towards the people they are supposed to protect and ensure that their fundamental rights are respected. So when the committee, and hopefully that will come soon, when the committee examines legislation amending the mandate and the powers of the Judicial Inspectorate, what we think is important is for that perceived independence to be reinforced. And that brings me to the legal mandate and the powers of the Judicial Inspectorate. Because at the moment, the mandate of the Judicial Inspectorate is mainly to inspect prisons and then to report on conditions of detention. And secondly, to deal with complaints. The Correctional Services Act says deal with complaints, but without providing any further details. And so that can be interpreted in many ways. And the judicial, both the Judicial Inspectorate and the Department of Correctional Services have actually interpreted this as investigating. We've seen, for example, in a recent report to the UN Human Rights Committee, the state writing that JICS is mandated to investigate complaints or alleged criminal activity in prison. To us, the wording of the Correctional Services isn't clear enough to actually provide an investigative mandate to the Judicial Inspectorate. That is mainly related to its powers, because the Act is quite clear on the powers in relation to inspections. The independent visitors have very clear powers as to who they can interview so always in private, have access to all parts of a prison, have access to all documents, etc. But then the Act is almost silent on investigative powers. All it says is that the inspecting judge can hold hearings and make inquiries in relation to these complaints he or she receives. Importantly, the inspecting judge, according to the Act, cannot receive complaints directly from inmates. It can only receive complaints from a variety of stakeholders. Many of them are related to DCS. It can act on his own volition, which is why he acts mostly on the complaints he does receive from inmates, despite the Act not providing for that. So the inspecting judge can hold hearings and make inquiries. But the staff of the Office of the Inspecting Judge has no powers whatsoever. The Act is completely silent on this. And the legislation regulating the Office of the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, and IPIT all give quite extensive powers to its staff. Its staff also has immunity from prosecution for any act for anything they would do in the course of their work, which JICSA's staff does not have. So whenever a member of the head office goes into prison to conduct an investigation, it has no protection whatsoever for whatever it does. So the question could be, well, why does JICS need an investigative mandate? Why does JICS need more investigative powers similar to what other oversight institutions have in the country. Well, let me briefly talk about assaults by officials on inmates. And it's one of many examples of the type of complaints that CCVs record on a daily basis. But this was this one is quite telling because whereas ICCVs are mostly required to first address complaints with a head of correctional center, when an ICCV receives a complaint of assault, and we know that some of these complaints are certainly baseless, but many do have some, certainly not all of them are baseless, but a complaint of assault cannot be dealt with internally. And so ICCVs record over 450,000 complaints a year, or last 2 years ago they did. 4,200 of those complaints were for assaults by officials on inmates. Out of these 4,200, 109 reached the Office of the Inspecting Judge. So 4,100 complaints of assault by officials on inmates were somehow dealt with internally within the prison. 4,100 complaints of assaults were not baseless. Some of them were actual assaults that did take place and then nothing happened. But then, so 109 of these complaints reached the Office of the Inspecting Judge. 45 of them, less than half, were actually forwarded by ICCVs. So less than half of the complaints that reached the Office of the Inspecting Judge were from ICCVs. The other ones were from inmates, from families, from people who are not supposed to directly address the Office of the Inspecting Judge. So the Office of the Inspecting Judge records 109 complaints of assault out of the 4,200 recorded by ICCVs, and then investigates 9 of them out of the 109. 100 of these complaints were just noted. We started with 4,203 complaints, and we have 9 investigated by the Office of the Inspecting Judge. And out of these 9, none of the officials who allegedly committed an assault were prosecuted or even charged. And I guess, how can this be about? How did 4,195 complaints disappear in the system? Well, currently, this is how complaints get recorded. An ICCV receives a complaint from an inmate, records it. And in very rare cases, as I said, in about 5% of cases, these get forwarded to JICS. They may possibly be investigated. DCS will most probably ignore JICS's recommendations. The annual reports of the inspectorate are full of desperate calls for DCS to listen to the institution. The police, who is still supposed to investigate a crime taking place in prison, does not go into prison to take statements, to collect evidence. And that would allow, and certainly does not do so swiftly, which would be necessary for an official to be charged if a crime did indeed take place. And when a JICS investigator goes in, he or she often goes in when it's too late and when evidence has been tampered with. So the system doesn't work, and we have to be very careful when we think of an adequate investigative mandate for JICS to make sure that evidence is collected quickly and that inmates see the inspectorate or any other investigative mechanism is legitimate, and because without legitimacy, it brings more violence in prison because it's the language that prisoners understand. And so, if we want to address violence, we must also make sure that their complaints are heard and adequately dealt with and swiftly dealt with. Well, that will be it on my side. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other thing from yourself? That's all. Nico, are you here? Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And I do apologize for being late. I thought it was at 10, but that was my responsibility to check. And I'm sorry I missed a little bit of CSPRI's presentation, but just getting on the back end of that, I mean, I'm sure it was mentioned that this discussion is not a new one, and NICRA has been part of the discussion since 2011 around JICs, when it was first raised by the inspecting judge then in 2011 to look at the mandate and independence of JICs. So it's not a new issue, and we have made input before. So I'm basically summarizing the input. There's been lots of discussion around JICs, and I think there's been a consensus around independence, financial independence, operational independence, and but there has been nothing done to move it forward. There's been no legislative amendments, and we are hoping that in this particular meeting that some action can be taken to take it forward. I think when we talk about independence, we don't talk about independence for the sake of independence. I think independence in oversight, especially over prisons, is very important. Prisons is one of those environments where it's not always easy to see what goes on, and that leaves inmates very vulnerable, and hence the need for an independent, properly functioning, effective mechanism. And international standards show that the most effective mechanism is an independent one that's financially independent, operationally, and administratively independent. And right now, this does not seem to be the case with JICs. And I think that's what's causing some of the challenges. Like the CSPRI says, compromising the integrity in the system, and it's being ineffective. And unless we address that, we're also not going to be able to see an effective inspectorate. So our interest as NICRO is obviously the human rights of inmates, and we would really like to see that this entity be strengthened. I think we support all of the issues that were raised by CSPRI in terms of an investigative mandate being stronger, because the recommendations now are, not that they're not taken seriously. We are aware that there is some committee at DCS that is supposed to look at JICs recommendations, but we never hear from that particular in terms of how they deal with some of the recommendations. In this committee, we do not see a running flow of recommendations that have been made and what have been addressed and what haven't. In our previous submissions, we have talked about an inspectorate model in the UK, although there has been research done by civil society, and I'm sure the DGF will present that, where we've looked at different countries, including African countries, around independent oversight mechanisms. And one of the key things, and Professor Minting always raises this, is the issue of performance and the issue of standards. So we have to know what we're measuring against. And one of our key inputs in previous times was that there is no standard in terms of, okay, yes, we have the Correctional Services Act, we have international instruments, there's good practice and prison governance, but I really feel that you need some sort of standard to monitor this prison against. Are these prisons properly being managed? I know Mr. Professor Minting raised before in terms of how our prisons should be managed, and it's an issue of management. How are we measuring that, and how is the inspectorate in a structured way monitoring that? So we see the annual report, we hear the complaints year in and year out, but there is no structure in terms of understanding what exactly is going on. How is this prison performing compared to Prison B, for example? And because we need to set some incentive for our prisons to also perform. I know there's centers of excellence, so there are some standards out there, but we don't see them, and I think this committee will benefit from also being able to see if there are standards that we can measure against it. So that's something we would really like to push for, and it's done in a more structured way. What we're also asking for is separate legislation, actually, is one of our recommendations for JICs, so that it completely gets its budget from Treasury, accounts to Parliament, and is a separate entity from the DCS. That's quite a radical shift, but that's really what we feel would be most effective. With regard to the ICCVs, I mean, NICRO, we deal with ICCVs on a regular basis. I myself contact ICCVs to deal with complaints coming from inmates. And, I mean, we know that our ICCs work hard on the ground. The ones that I've worked with really try their best, but they're not always equipped to be able to handle, some of the complaints. The inmates see them as part of the system, and they feel that the ICCVs serve the DCS. So they don't really see them as independent, and that really then compromises them wanting to be able to trust that a response will come. And anyway, those that have, sometimes they've had to wait a very long time before anything happens. And it's not always the ICCV's fault. They try their best. They run around to be able to address these issues. But in terms of the ICVs, CCVs we've had, what we've raised before, this is very important that communities do get involved. But to be able to work in a system like the DCS, you must be able to have, authority, but I don't know how ICCVs are seen by the DCS in terms of the way they would respect their views or respect the inspectorates. Well, I know that over the years they haven't respected the inspectorate's role, but I really think we need to look at the ICCV structure. And in our recommendations, we do talk about that needs to be strengthened, that even with the inspectorate itself, that we introduce specialist teams that look at medical care, that look at the issue of gang violence. I mean, there's experts that can look at those things to see, you know, what standards need to be developed there, and to be able to go in and offer more specialist input around how that particular prison can be governed better and all of that. So there's a lot that can be put into that. We also feel that more cooperation needs to be, yesterday we talked a lot about stakeholder collaboration, and we know that the JICS looks at prisons, but also the South African Human Rights Commission. So does LHR, so does NICRO. There's so many agencies looking at inmates in terms of complaints, and what we find is that some of these inmates are going from pillar to post in terms of complaints. So I would get a complaint, and I would, well, the first person I may send it to is the JICS. But if they aren't able to, then I will be contacting LHR or somebody else, with Justice Project, DDF members or whatever. And so it's going from pillar to post. And I don't think there's clarity also in terms of the South African Human Rights Commission and JICS's role with regard to prisons. The South African Human Rights Commission's reports on prisons to the UN, as I understand, because they will have to report on all human rights issues. So I don't think I know there's not a formal partnership between the South African Human Rights Commission and JICS. And we have had a discussion in Parliament before between those two bodies collaborating further. And I think in our previous submission we did talk about civil society. We're already involved, and we would like to contribute in a more effective way. In our recommendations we also talk about OMCAT and the ratification of that, which would introduce a national preventative mechanism to look at torture and detention, and that would have implications for the JIC structure as well as independent oversight in general. So we'd really like to push on that. But with regard to JIC's impact, I mean, the annual report is a very useful document, but I think there's a lot there that in terms of analysis that can be done. I think the JICs can do more in terms of engaging with stakeholders. They do have stakeholder meetings to present the annual report, but there's so much more content in that we can have workshops and seminars. And like you mentioned yesterday, Chair, where we can really start getting consensus around issues and moving them forward. So there's so much more we can do with regard to that. So like we said, we want to support that JICs be independent, that there be independent separate legislation, that the budget be separate of the DCS, that the JICs will manage their own finances, and that this would come from Treasury directly, that JICs be given more powers to enforce their recommendations, that also right now police cells, for example, are not being monitored, and hopefully when OPCAT is ratified, it means all detention centres would be monitored, but in the interim, that remains an issue. Police cells, although nobody monitors actually people in detention and police cells. Our other concern, and this I raised it in the submission, but it may not be maybe appropriate for JICS, but child and youth care centres, for example, they are quality assured by the Department of Social Development, but they are not independently monitored by anybody. And that's children that we're dealing with. So that is an issue we need to, because it is about children who are in lock-up kind of. Yeah, so I think, and we'd also like to see JICS. JICS plays a very low profile in terms of the media.
There's no harm in saving time for discussion.
Okay, no, I'm there right at the end. I just remembered one point about, I think because JICS is so working so closely with DCS, we don't see a lot of media coverage by JICS. And I think you need to be so strong when it comes to human rights issues, and that's what an independent body will be able to do. I think they try to work very closely with the JICS. It just, doesn't work in providing that kind of independence. So, that's mostly what we have to say regarding it. And we really hope that this time that we're not just presenting and that nothing's going to be done about it. So we really hope that concrete actions can be taken by this committee. The previous committee did a lot of work on it, and we're trusting that this committee will move it forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Pillay. We are talking about radical shifts. I think that must also apply to the language we use. Under apartheid, we're talking about reform. But when we campaigned for a new society, we're talking about transformation. So it would be important to hear that language reflected also by civil society, unless we just want to make adjustments to apartheid legislation or tinker with apartheid legislation.
Sorry, Chair, I like the word reform, but we can differ on that issue. I like reformation and reform, but we can differ on that issue. Thank you.
I think you are right. Maybe we need also to discuss it ourselves as a committee, but for me,
what is wrong with transformation?
Let's not debate it now, but it's good that the honourable members placed it on the agenda. I say this because, if I look at the delegation of Judge Van Vestdijsen, you see a non-racial delegation, but the civil society's organisations that are calling on us or on the department to comply with the constitution are not reflecting that transformation. You can hear something with the cell phone. Hello? Again? Okay. I think there's another cell phone. I'm saying that I think we should take the tune from the delegation of the judge. You can see the commitment in fact, not in theory, to transformation. As I said yesterday, I worked with the advocate Dala Omar from the 80s. He campaigned for a non-racial society, and Rector Jace Herwell opened his university to all races long before. So I think much as we want change in the laws and in the institutions of government, let's do that ourselves in our organization. And let's make this parliament a learning institution. When you come with interns, young students, so that they can also get an exposure, because we really need to use this opportunity to truly build a new South Africa, indeed, not in intentions. I hope that as we move forward, you'll take that into account, because, when we walk outside, people want to know what are we actually doing to change society? Otherwise, next time we'll find students sitting here occupying these chambers because they think we are saving ourselves and not the country. So please, let's take this matter seriously. Honorable members, now we can get questions on reform and transformation.
Yes, Chair, I'm sorry I didn't bring along an intern just to please you. This, as the presenters have said, is a long debate. I mean, it's been around for ages. And one of the reasons that it hasn't been prosecuted beyond the place that we got to in about 2013 is precisely because we have a committee that deals with both justice and correctional services. And if you want to have proper oversight over correctional services, and if you want to have transformation of post-apartheid legislation, then it would be useful to have a separate committee or subcommittee that dealt specifically with correctional services matters. But at the time that this was last debated, there was an issue before this committee as to whether or not it was better to have a specialized committee like JECS or whether this formed part of the mandate of the Human Rights Commission, and that the Human Rights Commission should in fact be beefed up or capacitated in some way to be able to deal with this. It would be useful to just one small canvas the presenters about that particular debate. The second thing is that I think, I'm not going to call her Gwen because that might get me into trouble, but there was a suggestion that the department is not responsive. Well, believe me, you're not alone. I mean, I can show you files and files and files of correspondence with the department that just goes unanswered from my office. I think it is an unresponsive department, generally. So you can put in a complaint or you can draw the department's attention to a particular matter. As a member of parliament, I assume the honourable judge as well, and it just simply gets ignored, whether that's because of So until there's a consequence in law for not dealing with matters, I'm not sure whether you're going to get any better system off the ground. Finally, there was another argument previously that we had that setting the JECS apart from the department would involve a degree of administrative capacity which would then, in a sense, make the JECS less effective than it is at the moment from an administrative point of view. That was the argument that was advanced at that time. Again, I would like to get reaction from that particular argument, because I think if we're going to go forward and hopefully either transform the post-apartheid legislation or introduce some new post-apartheid legislation, then it would be useful to get these debates out of the way so that we don't have to revisit them again and again and again.
Can I just say that that debate is important, but we should also bear in mind that there is a real situation out there that needs to be addressed, so that we don't spend time talking about whether to locate JECS in Human Rights Commission or whether to create another entity, but we must come out of here with contributions as to how that lack of response by the department can be dealt with, and how this committee itself can ensure that we hold them accountable, because we can't let them off the hook. They have to address the situation that exists. Honourable Lesort.
Thank you, Chair. We'll have the debates on reform and transformation elsewhere. I've got no objection to both words. That's all I wanted to say, Chair. But let's leave that. We can have coffee and discuss that. I think there's a more...
With Honourable
Yes.
Yes, we'll have come that. And report back.
We'll have that discussion. Chair, I just want to just indicate my concern about the state, the Ms. Clare that indicated, Ms. Ballard, about the fact that because they have not been able to have a meeting with the minister, they now have to resort to litigation. And I think this is something we need to raise with the minister. On page 6 of her submission, paragraph 19, one of the biggest components of the department is litigation and costs. Here, purely because they haven't been able to discuss this issue and find resolution, she says here, in an effort to avoid large-scale review litigation, Lawyers for Human Rights has requested a meeting.
That was yesterday's submission.
In general, I'm just talking about in general where you are also speaking about litigation pending now. The issue is what we need to try to avoid is the incurring of legal costs and to try to see as far as possible. I was always taught as a lawyer it's better to jaw than to war, because at the end of the day, legal costs have to be paid. So I want to say that this is an issue that we need to look into. Now, we have had discussions, and when I previously served on correctional services many, many years ago, Prof. Mutingi will remember the Jolly Commission, and we need to get that commission. It's shocking that none of the recommendations were followed on. Let's get that commission and look at it. That's the second issue. The third issue, why, Chairperson, can we not, in this term, have reform laws along the lines of the Independent Police Investigator? There is a law already that we can apply for JICs. And, Chair, we have asked the Minister, in the discussions, this has been coming up now since the new Parliament of 2014. We don't seem to be making progress. We're already halfway through our term. Why can't we consider, if the executive is not going to assist us, why don't we bring a committee bill? It's straightforward. There's the model. And we can maybe have a discussion around that. Why don't we consider working on a committee bill? We've done it in the past to alleviate this, so that civil society does not keep coming, and we are all at idem that there is a need for that legislation. There is a model already, and it's something for us to consider, Chair. I'm just putting it out there for our report purposes. Thank you very much, Chair.
You see, I remember that in the 80s, human rights organizations used to have what are called test cases. And the more test cases you win, the more funding you would attract from abroad. I hope that we won't continue with that culture, because as you correctly point out, we need more money for JICs to do their work, and the department already has lots of litigation which takes a lot of money. So if civil society organization is going to keep the department in court, so the recommendations that they make won't be implementable, because there will be no budget to implement those. Because I also don't believe that if you fail to secure an appointment with the minister, that is the last resort, because the minister accounts to this committee. So if you write to us and complain that you are unable to meet with the minister, we will ensure that the minister meets with you. So I think let's have what I would describe as a constructive engagement to resolve the challenges that we have, because I guess both civil society and ourselves wants to see the department work, wants to see the department deliver in the interest of the inmates and the country. So I think we are at one. But Honorable Swart, your proposal, I think that needs the attention of the committee. So I think we should note that. May we welcome Advocate Mshwana, and we got your apology. You are most welcome. But we didn't expect that you will try to be a backbencher this morning. Honorable Mutapo and Honorable Majaki.
honourable members and our presenters. Chairperson, I would like to align myself with the Honourable Swart and yourself, especially coming to issue of litigation vis-a-vis contractive engagement. I fully support your last words of saying that at least lawyers for human rights should write to the portfolio committee in that regard. I fully support that. It's better to engage constructively rather than to litigate, as it eventually taxpayers' money will be wasted by the department. And then I would like to thank NICRO for the presentation. A very, very thought-provoking and really encouraging. So what I would like to know is that in most cases, most of the presenters here made the benchmarking was with the international, made it through international instruments. None of them made reference to SADC or maybe Africa as a continent. So don't you think maybe if we start continentally before we resort to international instruments? I'm aware that some of them, as South Africa, we have ratified, but even the African, some of African conventions, we have ratified. So, as a member of AU, so why don't we just start continentally first in terms of benchmarking, not resort in most cases to international and given reference to the West and so forth? That's my humble submission. And issue of mandate and independence of JICS and issue of oversight over prisons, as alluded to by Ms. Pile, NICRO, is noted. Thank you, Chairperson.
In 1961, the International Commission of Jurists adopted what they called the rule of law in the African context. And from there, you have the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, but you will have the OAU Convention on the Rights of the Child. You will have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but you will have the AU Human and People's Rights Charter, which means African leaders and countries have always been mindful of the fact that laws must be contextualized. Even the human rights charters must be contextualized. We can apply international instruments and totally disregard our own domestic cultures. So I think part of the transformation that we are talking about is that even when we domesticate international charters, it doesn't mean that we must wipe away the African instruments themselves. So we must find a balance between all these things. So NICRO requests that in the good work that you do in future, reflect that your point of departure is the continent, not Europe or Asia. Thank you. Honorable Madam.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'd like to just continue to support the fact that we need to actually really be conscious of transformation. And I think the right label that is actually being used today is transformation. It's very important, taking into consideration the history that we come from. Chair has just commended the delegation of the inspectorate, but from my perspective, I would like to say I want to see more women sitting there. But, you know, that's how we are operating in terms of transforming the society, so that we have an inclusive democracy. Otherwise, we'll lie to ourselves to say that we have a democracy, but find that it's still excluding other people and therefore violates the principle of fairness. One thing that is important also is as we move forward as South Africans, we shouldn't continue to operate as if we do not believe in the democratic dispensation that we've got. The issue that is actually being brought forward today, if you look at it, and already we have mentioned that we have some of the institutions like South African Human Rights Commission, and we are asking ourselves the question as to how they come into play when it comes to looking at violation of the rights of the inmates in correctional centers, because this is an establishment that has got to do with protection of the Constitution to ensure that the rights of South Africans are not violated. So whatever arguments are actually put forward needs to actually take into consideration all that has already been set up. We are all very conscious of the fact that the inmates are not supposed to be violated. And when violations take place, they need to be dealt with swiftly. And we shouldn't come to a situation where you find that there will be reports that are not handled at all. But also what comes into play is the capacity of the office of the inspecting judge, whether JIGS has got enough capacity. Those are some of the things that we need to look at. And I'm thinking for now, what we hear is that the minister has been contacted and there's no response on the side of the ministers. I think it will be unpardonable, an indictment for us as members of parliament to say that the minister is not, because I hear some of the members are saying that the minister has not actually been responding. They've got quite huge correspondence or the department has not actually responded. But when civil society says that the minister has not responded, I don't think going to courts is an answer. Maybe what could have actually happened was for you to come to us so that we actually see to what extent we actually facilitate a meeting with the minister to see to it that the kind of response that you are actually requesting is actually addressed. But to go to court sometimes doesn't actually give the answer, in the sense that when you talk about anything, because also we shouldn't present arguments as if we are actually forever a civil society trying to look at the best possible way of taking control of establishments from the executive. Because for now, what you hear is independence, independence, independence. But that independence has got implication in terms of administration and logistical arrangements that are in the hands of the executive. And one thing that would actually be unfortunate is if you have civil society coming to present and you hear civil society talking as if it's some form of collusion, we need to have independent thinking that is presented. And we must actually say to NICRO that the arguments that you are putting forward are very valid, because then you actually look at it broadly. You're not actually only looking at JIGS. You look at police cells, for example, the child youth care centers. Are they properly monitored? And it actually then helps us in the sense that we then also then put in play the already developed instruments that South Africa has got. And then it says to us, do we want to actually look at how we are monitoring instruments? And also at implementation level, are we really having systems and mechanisms that manages to implement effectively all these instruments that we are actually having in place? Because indeed it's your responsibility as civil society not only to be a watchdog, but also to participate in processes that have got to actually make rich what already we've got as a country. And maybe what needs to come out of civil society also is to say, when it comes to monitoring of these instruments, what efforts are you actually putting forward? Then you don't depend on the minister alone, because Honorable Mutapo has indicated, then we have other structures in SADC, AU, United Nations, that would actually also help to look at this and really come up with a way of helping South Africa to respond to it. So basically, at the end of the day, I think what we've got is democracy.
And democracy, that is envied by quite a number of countries. But at the same time, we shouldn't behave towards it in a manner that sometimes undermines the very institutions that have been built into this democracy to help protect this democracy. Thank you, Chairperson.
Mrs. Bellet, I think we should assure you that you have all the right to approach the courts. But all we are saying is that, as you would know as a lawyer, there's a principle which says exhaust all internal remedies. And one of the remedies is that if any minister does not respond, you have the right to approach this committee. We will ensure that those ministers respond because they account to us. So that's why we also say that let's agree on constructive engagement to resolve these things without unnecessary expense of the taxpayers' money. So compliance really doesn't require the courts. We can enforce it ourselves, and we want to cooperate with you to get that done. You can always approach us. Any other contribution? Honorable members, also I think this applies to ourselves as members of this committee. If we have stacks of papers, complaints, I think let's place them before the committee, because we have the right to call the minister to come and explain why Honorable Self has accumulated lots of queries and they're not attended to. So no one should feel frustrated. We have the power to enforce it. Thank you very much. We are not referring to response by you, but by the stakeholders. I'm sorry for the confusion. Mr. Paul?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll attempt to answer Mr. Self's question about the institutional position of the inspectorate. I think it's firstly important to acknowledge that the fact that it's headed by a judge is a strength of the institution. So my answer follows from that. I think we need to distinguish in a future institution between the investigative function and the monitoring function. Again, the ICCV system is in principle, I think, a good one. It's members of the community engaging in prisons on an almost daily basis. But that the investigative function needs to be strengthened, and it needs to have power similar to that of IPIT in order to conduct effective investigation. In terms of positioning it, I would argue for keeping it as a separate and distinct institution. Institutions of this nature over time develop knowledge and expertise about the problem they're trying to solve. And there's a real fear that if it's assumed into a larger institution such as the Human Rights Commission, that may be lost. And that would undo a lot of good work that has already taken place. A further challenge that we've identified through our own research, and recall that I said earlier that this is a problem about impunity. And we cannot really resolve the issues of the inspectorate without looking at the National Prosecuting Authority and the relationship between JICS and the NPA and the extremely low rate of prosecutions and convictions is a real cause for concern, and that needs to be addressed in the long term. Lastly, a member of the committee mentioned that this looks like collusion amongst civil society organizations. The point that I've made earlier on in my introductory remarks, and other people here have also mentioned, is, and members of the committee also noted, is that this has been a long-standing problem. We've engaged on this numerous times with the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services, but also amongst ourselves and with the Office of the Inspecting Judge. So I can't speak on behalf of the other civil society organizations, but I think there's broad consensus on the way forward from civil society organizations who's deeply concerned about the state of our prisons at the moment. Thank you, Chair.
I understand. You say there's consensus to do what?
Chairperson, if I talk about consensus, I mean about concepts such as the independence, the importance of independence of the inspectorate, about their functioning, about their powers, about their mandate. And it's in those terms that I talk about this broad consensus.
I hear you. I had Mrs. Ballard also talking about independence of chicks, because you also don't want to appoint a judge to head an institution like this, and the judge must be running after officials asking for money and make his wealth depend on what pleases the department. And I think as this committee, we need actually to take a serious position on that matter. So I think we are beginning to go in the same direction. Maybe we should just need to work out, when we say independence, structurally and otherwise, how should that be constructed? Otherwise, it's just the formality that we have. Any other input? Ms. Ballard?
Thank you, Chair. A quick response, I think, to one of the members raised the importance of contextualizing norms and standards. And I'd like to point out that in our submissions, we raise at least four regional instruments, Ouagadougou, Mandela Rules, which are international, but completed here, Robben Island, that's also in Africa, and the African Charter, all of which we've referenced. We're failing to uphold our own regional standards. This is not some concoction from international law or from the West. These are our own African standards we are failing to meet. So I think it's vitally important to mention that. This isn't something we're importing from anybody from anywhere else. These are African problems and an African standard that we're failing to address. Constructive engagement and litigation.
Take African solutions to African problems, so I can see you are moving in the right direction.
And I'm using our South African constitution as a benchmark, which requires that there be an independent oversight watchdog. There currently isn't one. So our own democratic constitution provides for this, and it's that standard that we want to use. I'm a bit concerned that there's this idea that we haven't attempted to engage constructively. We spent close to 7 years doing that. This doesn't rest or fall with whether or not there has been a meeting with the minister. The business of legislative reform lies with Parliament. Thank you.
We are not saying you have not engaged constructively. We are saying the court should be the last resort. Engage constructively, not only with the minister, but if the minister is not helpful, come to this committee. We will ensure that the minister responds. So we are not criticizing you for not having done anything. We're just making a suggestion as to how we should work together going forward. And I like your forceful presentation of your position. That's what you want. We want from you. You are doing it very well.
If I may just add on the... thank you, Chair. On the issue of regional instruments and this not or needing to look at African instruments, South Africa was reviewed by the African Commission on Human and People's Rights in April. The issue of the judicial independence was raised. before the African Commission, and I'm sure that the committee is aware of this and is aware of the recommendations of the African Commission in relation to the objects in the pens. Thank you.
Is this organization, is it Open Democracy, Open Society? Open Democracy Society. You see, they produce booklets on the work that they do. And we should also suggest to yourself that when you talk about these regional instruments, summarize them, produce booklets, translate them into other languages, so that when we talk, you talk to us, we know that the people you are representing have access to the positions that you advocate. Otherwise, we may be tempted to think that you are talking from an ivory tower, and that there's no relationship between what you say and what the aspirations of the people are. So, in short, we are saying, let's take along the constituencies that we are representing. Thank you.
Listen, we must all apologize because you started calling Miss Pile and everybody started saying Pile.
Yeah, maybe you should just call her Vanessa.
No, I just want to... Yeah.
It's just that there are too many other Piles in the parliament and we call you...
That's the problem.
But I do want to respond to... thank you very much for your comments. I mean, we've listened to it carefully and appreciate your intention behind it. And it's true, and as Ms. Ballard mentioned now, the Ballard, Africa has a lot to boast in terms of prison regulations around prison reform, and it's quite progressive with the Ouagadougou Declaration and all of that. So, and just to say that although I didn't put it in the NICRO submission, like I said, NICRO is also a member of the Detention Justice Forum. And when a research study was done by the forum, it did take into account African models. And the two we found around prison inspectors was the one in Malawi. There's a prison inspectorate in Malawi. And in Ghana, there is a judicial visits kind of system. And in Malawi, it said, according to Section 1692 of the Malawian Constitution, the inspectorate of prisons shall exercise its powers, functions, and duties independent of any direction or interference by any other person or authority. So the issue of independence, I mean, it's also in an African, from Malawi, that's what they've applied as well. And they've also, So with Ghana, we couldn't, they also have a system of judicial visits. But to say that we have been looking, even in Africa, to look at where we can find best practice models that can guide us.
Okay, you should say we have been looking also in Europe. So the starting point is Africa and then also in Europe. Because it's not only yourself, you know, our weakness also is Parliament. When we go abroad to study, we go to Europe. And when we come back, we know more about Europe than Africa, and we want to impose European solutions on African people, and it can't be right. So this applies to all of us, and then we are saying as this committee going forward, Africa is our point of departure. We are Africans at the southern tip of the continent, and we can borrow outside before we make sure that we don't have a solution internally. Mandela used to tell a story of a man who left his home, went through the whole world looking for a beautiful girl to marry. When he came back, he discovered that the type of girl he wanted was next door, and he had already wasted money. He had no lobola to pay for that girl, and somebody took the girl. So we shouldn't find ourselves in that situation. Do we need a
Welcome back. Comfort break, eh? Don't believe in comfort break.
I'm taking a little one here.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
How are you? I'm okay. How are you? We are on the lookout for your presentation.
Oh,
so
yes.
For whatever reason, I don't know why. So
I can forward it to you if you drop
yes,
me.
Yes, please, in email. In fact,
I
can
don't
give
why,
you.
But I have no idea, but give it to me.
Sure.
Like, on the bus.
Sure.
Diala.
Yep.
Okay. At UCT?
I'm using my UCT address for now.
Okay.
I check it more often.
Okay, I'll probably only send it later. So
okay, cool. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
mush.
Yes.
You've been excited and done that.
Honorable members, let's start our meeting and have the door at the back closed. Gender justice are here, and they've given us a very nice package, and they have a very nice name, but like others, not representative of the South African society. And we want to repeat that delegations to Parliament must also show that the organization that we receive here take transformation seriously and contribute to building a non-racial South African society. And that includes transferring skills to the youth and ensuring that the youth participate as intense and otherwise, so that we can make an impact in our work. The floor is open to you, and you are most welcome.
Thank you, Chair. I take your points on transformation seriously, and I'll bring my research with me next time. My name is Ariane Nevin. I'm the National Prison Specialist running Sonke Gender Justice's Prison Transformation Program. I think I'm going to be speaking. The layout of my presentation is as follows. I'll start by speaking about the value of a prison oversight body, such as JICS, and then I will follow up with what we think needs to be done to make JICS effective. Much of what I'll say in this regard has already been said, so I will try not to linger too much on this. I will briefly touch on the issue of litigation that was raised by Lawyers for Human Rights, because Sonke Gender Justice is the client in that matter. And then I will take any questions. I know the topic may seem dry and technical, but as we know, the purpose of a prison oversight body is to protect the human rights of inmates. Inmates are particularly vulnerable because they're deprived of their freedom and they're hidden from the public eye.
and the purpose of any oversight body, and particularly this one, is to open prisons to scrutiny and to protect against human abuse and neglect of a very vulnerable group of people. So when inmates are sexually abused, when they are unable to access their antiretrovirals or their TB treatment, when they are assaulted, or when they are subjected to inhumane conditions like those in Palsmore Remand Detention Facility, which I know the committee has heard about recently, that's when we need a very robust and responsive prison oversight body. JICS, therefore, has a very vital role to play in protecting and promoting the rights of inmates, and it can only do this effectively if we address issues that we have all been speaking about today and over the last few years. So I said I would talk a bit about how to make JICS more effective. I think the recommendations that we've made can be classified under two main groupings. The one is JICS's functions and powers, and the corresponding obligations of DCS. And the other is JICS independence. So in terms of JICS's functions and powers, it's very unclear whether JICS has proper investigative powers. The word investigate is only used once in Section 90 of the Correctional Services Act, and otherwise the inspecting judge has the power to deal with complaints, but this isn't expanded on. If you compare this to the empowering statute of IPED, which has extensive regulations about what investigate means, what the powers, the extent of the powers, and how to exercise them, I think you can see that there's a remarkable difference. JICS is also not empowered anymore to investigate corrupt or dishonest practices, or necessarily to investigate systemic issues like overcrowding. And finally, what are DCS's obligations following a JICS report? Does it have an obligation to respond, to provide an action plan, to demonstrate that it's meeting its obligations? And how are JICS and the DCS to be held accountable? Is JICS to be held accountable? How is JICS held accountable for not resolving complaints, for example? In terms of independence, the independence of an institution, as we've heard, can be broken down into four main criteria. So the first is financial autonomy. Where does it receive its budget from? Does it have control over its expenses? Does it have the right necessary resources to fulfill its functions? Secondly, we talk about operational autonomy, which is that requires that a body has a clear statutory mandate and the authority to determine its own processes. This can also be considered administrative autonomy. Another criteria is employment security for the body's employees, to allow them to carry out their duties vigorously and fearlessly without worrying that if they upset the wrong people, their contracts will not be renewed. Finally, we talk about associational independence, which acts as a safeguard against the potential for oversight bodies to become too sympathetic with the department that they are overseeing or too reliant on them for carrying on their duties. So if we look at the operational independence of JICS, it has in the past, in 2013 and 2014, reported that its reliance on the DCS administrative systems have actually hindered its work. So in 2013 and 2014, for example, delays by DCS in the creation of posts and the payment of salaries forced JICS to appoint staff on a contractual basis. This compromises the institutional experience and knowledge and continuity in service provision, and it also has a knock-on effect for employment security. Another area is financial independence. As we know, JICS receives its budget from DCS, which compromises its financial independence. And it has itself noted that this has in the past caused serious operational challenges and delays in service delivery. It also gives DCS the power to undermine JICS by limiting its resources, and it disincentivizes JICS from reporting robustly on DCS for fear that it will risk losing resources. In terms of employment security or insecurity, the term of many JICS staff members is determined by the CEO on their appointment, which doesn't provide much employment security. And there's also a knock-on effect of the DCS administrative control of JICS operations, which has resulted in staff being employed only on temporary contracts. finally, in terms of associational independence, evidence indicates that independent correctional center visitors are at risk of institutional capture, which means they're likely to sympathize a lot with DCS officials and not to necessarily fulfill their functions. And this is possibly born of the fact that they rely on DCS officials for access to inmates to keep them secure and safe when they're in prisons, and often makes them very vulnerable to influence. This indicates that even at a ground level, JICS is not fully independent. So what are our recommendations? I think we submit that the Correctional Services Act needs to be developed or amended, or we need new legislation similar to that of the IPED Act, which one of the honorable members spoke about earlier. And its powers need to be clearly defined, and we need detailed guidelines on the JICS investigative powers, for example. JICS should also be required to provide mandatory reports on systemic challenges such as overcrowding, understaffing, which affects DCS officials as much as it affects inmates, and the impact of these. And also the power to make disciplinary recommendations, to refer cases for prosecution, and to cooperate closely with the National Prosecuting Authority. In terms of independence, JICS needs to be completely structurally independent from the department that it is overseeing. My colleagues and comrades have spoken about this already, so I'm not going to go into it in too much detail. Their budget should be allocated by Treasury, and JICS should have exclusive control over its own operations. Other recommendations that we've also made are that it should be an offence to hinder the work of JICS. So, for example, an IPID is a legal or criminal offence to actually obstruct the work of investigation or of investigators. The inspecting judge should be able to act as a complaint mechanism for NGOs and service providers as well. For example, if an NGO or a service provider providing vital services in DCS facilities is refused access to those facilities for an irrational reason, they should be able to have a recourse with the judge. Finally, I'm going to speak a little bit about the litigation. We've heard a lot about how we needed to engage constructively, and that's definitely agreed. But if you look at the last 5 years of engagement with this committee alone, in 2011, we had 2 meetings in which independence was discussed. In 2012, we had 9 meetings in which independence was discussed. In 2013, we had 5 meetings in which the independence and issues of JICS were discussed. In 2014, 7 meetings. And in 2015, 5. So, we are... Not at all, Chair. I think the point is that we have engaged exhaustively, we feel, with very little to show for it. And so I would like to end off by urging the committee to actually take action now and to start developing, as suggested, a committee bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I need to thank you for when you don't just talk about independence, you spell out what you mean, and that will assist us to engage. Honourable Member.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the opportunity to make the submission. So Just Detention International South Africa is a health and human rights organization, and we're dedicated to ending sexual abuse, specifically in places of detention. Sexual violence in prison is a systemic and widespread problem with devastating consequences both for inmates but for broader society as well. It is shrouded in stigma and taboo and shielded by the closed nature of prisons and inadequate scrutiny of conditions inside them. So it's been the rape of prisoners has been kept in the shadows and allowed to continue with relative impunity. And robust prison oversight is an essential component that we need to tackle sexual abuse and other forms of violence behind bars. And I think my colleagues have said how this was this issue of JICSA's independence was put on the table many years ago and has been done consistently, including by the Jali Commission, and highlighted various shortcomings with JICS, with JICS as it is currently. But also, I think, you know, it's important to acknowledge that considering the limitations, it's also added a great deal to prison oversight since its establishment. But its capacity is severely limited in its current current structure. I also want to acknowledge that fellow NGOs like CSPRI, LHR, Sonke, and NICRO have done much more detailed work on these issues, and we're very indebted to them for the now very substantial body of work and analyses that they've produced and which have really helped to crystallize key issues in need of attention. And I think much of what I've said, what I will say, has already been said, and I'm not going to go through it in huge detail, but just to touch on things for the benefit, I guess, of reiteration, but also showing that JDI is in support of the those recommendations. So the first key recommendation is that legislation governing JICS should be revisited to ensure independence from DCS. I think, yeah, it's been made abundantly clear that its current dependency on DCS in various aspects is counterproductive. To achieve meaningful independence, JICS should have its own budget and receive its funding directly from Treasury. It should be administratively separate from DCS. The minister should also be required to consult with the inspecting judge when developing regulations that affect the work of JICS. So we've seen that, for example, the minister can unilaterally make regulations that affect JICS, but without having consultation with JICS. And also the process for the appointments of the inspecting judge and the CEO of JICS should be reviewed to put in place measures to prevent possible political interference. JICS's mandate requires review and strengthening so that it clearly states its functions and powers. And I think all the other presenters have discussed this, that the mandate is not clearly defined. Specifically in relation to investigation, there's mention of it, but it's not unpacked about what this may involve. So to strengthen JICS's mandate, we propose that the governing legislation must be reviewed to clearly delineate JICS's powers and functions, and at a minimum, these should include the power to inspect, monitor, investigate, report, and make recommendations, as well as to hold DCS accountable through, for example, mechanisms such as binding recommendations. At the moment, DCS is not required to account to DCS, to JICS. DCS should be legally obligated to respond to reports and recommendations made by JICS, detailing a plan on how it will address the issue, which should then be open to monitoring by JICS. JICS should be given clear investigative powers and have the power to make binding decisions regarding the referral of criminal cases to the South African Police Service and the National Prosecuting Authority, and to make recommendations on instituting disciplinary proceedings. To enhance JICS's oversight capabilities, we believe that it should be empowered to investigate serious cases such as DCS staff involvement in torture, assault, sexual abuse, and unnatural deaths, and make binding decisions regarding their referral to SAPS and the NPA. Cooperation, as Ariane mentioned, cooperation with JICS inspections and investigations by agencies such as DCS, SAPS, and the NPA should also be required in law. And JICS should be empowered to make disciplinary recommendations regarding DCS officials. And that's also a sort of recommendation drawn out of the way in which IPID currently operates. Measures are needed to ensure as well that key challenges affecting the efficacy of ICCVs are addressed, including removing their reliance on DC, DCAs to conduct their work and building their capacity and support structures. And I think ICCVs have certainly, you know, battled under very difficult circumstances and done a phenomenal job considering, but key things really inhibit their work. So they are heavily reliant, as has been said, on DCA for basic tools such as connectivity, computers, office space, and to just access basic information about inmates. This can contribute on their part to a reluctance to antagonize DCAs. I think also the model of a single visitor per institution is potentially problematic considering the kind of bullying potential of individuals. Also, many ICCVs pursue a career with DCAs after the end of their relatively short periods with JICs, and I think others have also raised the importance of their having greater job security. They have very limited contact with the inspecting judge and higher levels of JIC staff, which could very meaningfully enhance their capacity. And they are also inadequately prepared for their roles. So they're required to have a matric and receive very limited training to prepare them for the complaints received by inmates. And researchers over the years, including CSPRI's early research, noted the gap between the training of ICCVs and the lived experience of inmates and the types of complaints they're receiving. So our recommendations in relation to ICCVs are that they should have greater job security. Obviously, JICS requires its own operational systems and infrastructure. And I think just for the sort of perhaps seemingly minor fact of having email addresses that are DCS email addresses is totally unacceptable for the Judicial Inspectorate. They should have direct lines of communication with senior JIC staff. They should be very well versed in human rights, and there should be measures in place to underscore to them repeatedly their absolute obligation for impartiality and independence. And I think that requires a great deal of support when working as individuals in a context like this. The training needs to be robust, ongoing, and specifically geared towards anticipated complaints from inmates, including systemic issues such as violence, torture, sexual abuse. Sexual abuse, for example, is especially difficult to report, and very specialized training is required in order to receive those sorts of complaints and know what to do, just as one example. And be prepared for a range of nuanced responses, which really involves having a sort of nitty-gritty understanding of a range of complex issues. They should also be accompanied by or have access to a team of professionals such as lawyers, healthcare practitioners, drug treatment specialists, social workers, forensic experts, former prisoners, etc., who can support ICCVs with complex complaints and potential intimidation from DCS officials. And the Act at the moment does provide for specialist assistance, but this is not being used. Finally, there is also a need for greater awareness among inmates and the broader public on the role of JICs. I think there's consensus that general awareness and visibility of JICs is relatively weak. Inmates are also often unaware that independent visitors even exist and of their basic right to access them. And although JICs has made its content available online, its visibility is still murky. JICs could promote transparency regarding DCS facilities by optimizing its unprecedented access. And again, the annual reports produced by JICs have been incredibly helpful and vital, containing vital information that otherwise would not be in the public realm, but we believe there's a lot more that could be done. That all inmates on their arrival in prison and throughout the duration of incarceration should be required to inform them about their right to lodge a complaint with JICs. JICs should highlight in the public realm that inmates, families, and the general public can lay a complaint on behalf of an inmate, and it could use the media as a tool to raise public awareness and garner public support. For example, sharing information on its role and work and issuing releases on its findings. In conclusion, as others have mentioned, you know, there've been numerous submissions to this committee over the years. Following 2012 and 2013 discussions with this committee, the committee undertook to hold a workshop to really thrash out these issues and take steps forward. Unfortunately, that didn't ever happen. We're very sort of relieved that the current committee is renewing a focus on this issue and would like to urge it to urgently address the inadequacies of JICS so that it can, as soon as possible, begin to effectively fulfill its duties to ensure inmates' rights. Thank you.
Also to say to all of you that the capacity that you have and the insights that you have, we don't have them in this parliament, so you are an important resource for us. So don't give up and think that because in the past there were no responses that you will continue to be frustrated. So you have our support. Honourable members, it's open. Honourable Maiza.
Thanks very much, Chair. And maybe let me thank all the presenters from the first one to the last. You know, Chair, when I listen to all the presentations, I hear that there are very strong arguments which are being put forward. And most touch on the need to revise the legislation in line with maybe making JICS to have financial and operational independence, to have an investigative mandate. But on the other side, there are also other suggestions which indicate that if something could be done, the operational capacity of JICS can be enhanced. So what I'm saying is these are points which are not falling on deaf ears. They really need to be discussed. The only problem would be if they are presented in a manner which says, if not this way, then the highway. They must not come as suggestions which seem as conclusions. We need to discuss these issues. It's a fair fact. There are other issues raised which indicate that as this committee we need to relook at, so that if there were you pointed out that there was a workshop suggested. I think it really needs to happen. Maybe the problem could have been we talked issues, we never set timelines, and issues fell by the wayside. There's also an indication that in the first presentation or the second, if I'm not mistaken, that there were about more than 3,000 complaints which were forwarded to JICS. But almost all of them fell on the wayside and only 9 were considered. And out of those, nothing happened, which is a point of concern. And we really need to talk about these things. So, but lastly, Chair, I would like to come to your point on transformation, that we don't just need transformation, we need radical transformation. We need radical transformation, and we take that serious. And we expect all of us to follow that example. You know, in areas where we come from, there's most of you portray could be very useful. So if all of us could really take this issue of transformation for the country, not for Jigs, for the country as a whole. I think, Chair, those were my points. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Maina, Honorable Ajake, and Honorable Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. At this stage, to thank Sonke Justice and JDI for the presentation. Very informative. But Sonke Justice, my disappointment with you is one. When you say Sonke Justice, I got excited to say now somebody's going to be telling us about the situation of women in prison. And I was waiting for that so that it actually then talks to your mandate. But I didn't really quite get it because it's all of our concerns about the situation of women and their children, because some will keep their children to a particular age. But I just couldn't get that from your presentation, and it's a little bit disappointing. I'm a gender activist, and when somebody says gender, then I start opening my ears very wide, and I want to hear if issues of gender are not really neglected. And it will be good, maybe moving forward, if you have to advocate for JICS, also to bring in that dimension in a way that actually helps us to understand the extent of the problem from your perspective as an institution that is there to actually look at issues of gender. And I'm sure there are many, many issues that have got to do with women in prison, and they may actually be connected to what JDI has actually presented in terms of sexual abuse in prison. But remember also, it doesn't only happen to women when it comes to sexual abuse. It actually goes beyond women. It affects also men. And also, I may actually say to CSPR, when you reported about the incidences of violence against inmates in correctional services, what would be also very helpful in future when you actually want to put forward this argument about what is happening in correctional services is to say there's so many cases of violence against inmates by officials, but also we know that there are cases of violence between inmates themselves. So that, you know, you actually look at it broadly. It shouldn't actually look like it's something that is just concerned about the officials, and if there's other types of violations, then they don't really matter. But at the end of the day, I think like the chairperson is saying, we can hear you. We know that the situation in correctional services is very difficult. Something drastic needs to happen. You spoke, JDI, about the readiness of the ICCVs, the fact that they've got matric and they get training, and to think that the training is not sufficient, and you are saying that the CSPR research outcome is such that it actually says that maybe they are not even prepared for the kind of problems that they are going to be experiencing. So also that area needs to be looked at. I think here it's not only about the mandate of JICS, it's about the whole conglomeration of problems. And maybe it says to civil society itself, what role are you playing in this? Because, you know, civil society needs to be there to fill in the gaps where government can actually manage to reach, because, you know, the work of government to address needs of people is so broad that there will obviously be gaps, and that's what actually makes it so important to have civil society, for civil society to go and fill in those gaps. And you talk about the fact that the ICCVs require maybe a team, and that team maybe should actually begin also from civil society to see to what extent you actually capacitate them to bring in those kinds of expertise that you were actually mentioning. By the end of the day, like the chairperson is saying, civil society is very important for governance, and civil society must be there also to fill in the gaps. And of course, civil society should be a watchdog But you know, the voice shouldn't only be the voice of a civil society that is a watchdog. When you look on the ground, you find that the needs are so big and broad, and nobody's making any intervention because there's so many areas where there is need for intervention. And it's not only happening in South Africa, it happens throughout the world. And that's why we've got something called civil society. Thank you, Chairperson.
Jackie, Honorable Schacht.
Thank you, Chair. I think the challenge is that we are, again, 2.5 years into our term, Chairperson, and I'm hoping that CHICS will respond to a way forward quickly to deal with some of the issues, and particularly the legislative reform, as I indicated earlier, that we could try to finalise it. Because I can understand the frustration of civil society coming, where you've got new MPs every time trying to raise the same issues. And I think that's when there was an indication of the numbers of meetings. There was reference to 2011, 2012, 2013, and that was the previous committee. Yes, there might be one or two new members. I served many, many years ago in correctional services, and the issues are the same. They're the same from when I was here in 1999 to 2004. So I think, Chair, we need to really have a commitment on, and try to, we'll hear from CHICS what their views are on the legislative reform. Over tea, I chatted briefly that there are discussions with the department, but we don't need, there isn't time for more workshops and discussions and that. We need to just, we are broadly in agreement, broadly. I understand there would be policy considerations, Chair, but you indicated that we need to find a way to address these issues and the useful suggestions that have been made. Here is a very useful booklet, Chair, that you indicated earlier, where the booklets. Here's a very interesting booklet. And I think, having worked with a number of the civil society institutions over the years, they're not only doing watchdog functions. NICRA doesn't, it's not only watchdog. They play a huge role in prison rehabilitation. So this particular workshop is related to CHICS, but besides that, it's not just only work oversight that is performed. It's a very, very important function that civil society is playing. But I would hate us to sit again, and I understand that we are largely reliant on the executive for legislative amendments, and we've got a heavy legislative load. But we can't sit halfway through, and we're starting to talk halfway through our term of office now. It's 2.5 years in this parliament. Again, to have a workshop and another more consultation. That's why I have a sense of urgency that we should try to have a way forward, but we have got broadly agreements about, to deal with the challenges of CHICS, the recommendations that can be speedily, the quick wins, and then to see to what degree we can agree on some way of dealing with the legislative reform as quickly as possible, Chair. Thank you.
No, I agree with you that we shouldn't be workshopping. But you know, the challenge that we have is that we have been working so much in silos. In silos, we call it. And not actually implementing even the recommendation where there is consensus. We're dealing with a piece of legislation which shocked me because it was suggesting that we reduce the age of maturity because children are committing crimes, and therefore we say we want to catch these children, send them to prisons that are already overcrowded, and nobody talks about arresting the deepening moral generation in society which produces criminals among children. We have a moral generation movement established in 2002. Nobody calls that movement to say, what are you doing about moral degeneration? Where is your program? But at the end, we keep on putting money into these structures. We never ask these structures whether they are still relevant, and if they are relevant, what impact are they making? I
think we need to follow up on the conference that we proposed yesterday. You know, to really also not to have civil society saying improve things in prisons, put more budget. They also must tell us what is it that they are doing outside to address the situation, because already communities are saying this government is looking well after the prisoners and not the victims of crime. And how do we address that? You know, if you are a criminal, the day you are arrested, you are entitled to a lawyer, and then you go into prison, you have food, three courses of a meal, then you have television, you have all these things. And what are we saying to the victims outside? Because the legal system itself may be delegitimized in the eyes of the people. And what is that going to, where is that going to lead us to? So I'm saying, in short, we need to look at this whole situation holistically. And therefore, with the good work that civil society is doing, if we meet in January, and from our side we'll put together a team that must start working immediately, but the purpose of the January meeting must be finalize our consensuses and move into legislation. And we are not going to depend on the department. We have the right ourselves to introduce legislation, and that's what we must do. But I think that the response of the JICS will help us, because also we don't want to treat JICS like they are small children. We must all research on them and make suggestions on how they should operate. I think they must sit themselves and say, these are the inadequacies, this is what we want to do, and they actually help us move forward, you know, taking into account the good work that has already been done. But for now, allow me to invite the South African Law Commission, Human Rights Commission, to make their presentation. I see there's a strong team at the back, and I leave it up to them to decide who should make the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson, and and colleagues around this chamber. I want to start by extending an apology from Commissioner Titus, because in terms of our internal arrangement, he is the responsible commissioner dealing with this particular matter. But when you are a part-time commissioner, it's sometimes difficult to be always available. I will leave it to Fadla. She will make the presentation, and then I will add and respond to questions later. Thank you, Chair.
I can see you are a sacrificial lamb because the advocate is not here, but we trust you do a good job. Proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable members of the committee. We have already circulated our presentation to the committee members, so I'll be making reference to that. I am aware of all the comments that have been made this morning, and also that there are quite a lot of duplications between what we will be presenting and what has been said. And in the interest of time, I will go to more of the salient features in the Human Rights Commission's presentation. We were also part of the discussions in 2011, 2012, 2013. In fact, there was a request from the then Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services for the Commission to brief it on strengthening the Judicial Inspectorate, and several recommendations were made at that time. I'm not sure if it was ever then translated into the handover report which was given to this committee. But just to touch on some of the issues which we raised in 2013 and which still remain today, I'll be touching on that a bit later. The committee is aware, I'm on page 3 of our presentation, but the committee is aware of the mandate of the commission. We've appeared several times before this committee as our the committee which we report to. And just specifically in relation to
inmates, conditions of detention, etc. The Commission's mandate extends to work in those areas, including children in conflict with the law, detained persons, people in police holding cells, military barracks, etc., migrants or foreign nationals. On a an institutional level with the Judicial Inspectorate, we have a very good, strong working relationship with the Inspectorate, but there's obviously room for improvement. At the outset, I think it's important to perhaps look at the two institutions, so from the Human Rights Commission side as well as the Judicial Inspectorate side, and what our enabling legislation dictates and how that is then interpreted into our mandate. The committee is aware of our Chapter 9 affiliation, that we are an institution supporting democracy, that we have an A status internationally, which means that we are in compliance with the Paris Principles as South Africa's national human rights institution. Conversely, the Judicial Inspectorate is established by the Correctional Services Act and is a statutory body. Our Act, as amended in 2013, so Act 40 of 2013, provides for our composition, our powers, commissioners, etc., whereas the Correctional Services Act also provides for the appointment of the inspecting judge and is a lot more limited in its provisions because it's incorporated within the Correctional Services Act and not standalone legislation. We have raised previously our concern that the JI doesn't have wide-ranging investigative powers. It doesn't have search and seizure powers as the Human Rights Commission does, and that they may issue recommendations really only to the department. Whereas in the case of the Commission, our recommendations can be issued to any government department, any individual juristic body, etc. I also think that it's critical to re-emphasize what has been said in the room this morning around the independence of Judicial Inspectorate, and specifically from the Human Rights Commission's angle. The Constitution clearly indicates that as a Chapter 9, the Human Rights Commission is independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law, whereas the Correctional Services Act says that the Judicial Inspectorate is an independent office under the control of the inspecting judge. So we've just noted that as something which maybe the committee may wish to explore if there is a discussion around future legislation to be a lot more clear in the independence provisions around the Judicial Inspectorate. In terms of reporting as well, the Human Rights Commission reports directly to this committee, to Parliament, and whereas we find that with the Judicial Inspectorate the line is a bit blurred also by reporting to the National Minister and in Parliament, it's not as clear. I am going to skip just to jump into our complaints handling procedures and the more nitty-gritty around how we engage with the Judicial Inspectorate and also recommendations to strengthen the impact of the work of the Inspectorate. As I mentioned at the outset, we do enjoy a good relationship with the Judicial Inspectorate. Our complaints handling manual or procedures specifically indicate that where a matter is before us, whilst we may have the jurisdiction to look into it, if we find that there is a body which can more effectively deal with the complaint, I'll specifically read what our complaints handling manual says. And it goes, if the provincial manager makes a finding that the complaint does not fall within the jurisdiction of the commission or could be dealt with more effectively or expeditiously by another organization, institution, statutory body, or institution created by the Constitution or any other applicable legislation, the complaint must be referred to such appropriate organization. And we cross-reference this then with Section 90 of the Correctional Services Act, which speaks to the mandate of the Commission. I'm sorry, not of the Commission, of the Inspectorate. So bearing this in mind, the SHRC's relationship with the Judicial Inspectorate, our complaints handling manual, as well as Section 90 of the enabling legislation, we have generally referred all matters relating to correctional services to the Judicial Inspectorate. The referral has differed depending on, or rather the mechanisms around referral has differed depending on the province we find ourselves in. So So, for example, in the in Gauteng and Western Cape, we find that the relationship works quite well, whereas in some of the other provinces, it's not as smooth a referral process, or it could be improved upon. We are also reiterating that financial constraints do place a tremendous burden on the Commission to fully execute our monitoring in respect of places of correctional or correctional centres in South Africa. So therefore, we do refer the complaints to the Judicial Inspectorate. But where possible, we have requested to assist the JI as well as accompany them on visits to the prisons, particularly in those matters where we have referred cases. Like I said, more smooth in the bigger provinces, but not as smoothly in the smaller provinces in South Africa. We would like in future going ahead that there is a clearer line between the JI and the Commission, so when we do refer matters that there's an automatic system which informs us on the progress and the updates of a particular case which we have referred. We find that that's a little bit lacking. Many, many years ago, in the early days of the Inspectorate, there was a talk around the Human Rights Commission and the JI, and I know one of the colleagues has just stepped out, but I recall having discussions with the JI at the time around having an online or electronic system where we can monitor the system of complaints and vice versa. But I'm not sure what the progress has been since, and it seems to not have taken off as planned. On the plus side, we also have the Judicial Inspectorate sitting on our Section 11 Committee on Human Rights in Places of Detention, which the Chair will speak to. However, and I fast forward here again just to skip some of the repetition in what was said by other speakers this morning, the recommendations from our side to improve the impact of the Judicial Inspectorate as per the brief which was sent by the committee to our offices. I am specifically going to extract those recommendations which pertain also to our work with the inspectorate. So, in addition to what was said earlier around independence of judicial inspectorate, that the judge, that the budget should be separate, we feel that the inspectorate should also have its own legal personality, which sets out that the inspectorate has standing in law and can be sued and can sue, that the appointment of the judge, that there should be a review on how that appointment process takes place. If one looks at the appointment of persons to Chapter 9 institutions, it's very different to the appointments of the inspecting judge. We've recommended previously that the JIC should have greater investigative and enforcement powers. Earlier I mentioned that they should be equipped with the powers of subpoena, search and seizure, similar to that of the Human Rights Commission. Let me just skip here. The public perceptions as well as inmate perceptions around the JICs, prior to coming to the meeting this morning, just glanced again at the Judicial Inspectorate's website, and it's concerning that their online presence is still hosted by the department. That doesn't bode well for public perception of the independence of Judicial Inspectorate. Similarly, my colleague has earlier mentioned that the website still has the DCS or rather not the website, email addresses are still via DCS, which is concerning. I skip again. At the same time, we recommend that the recommendations of the JIC should be made enforceable, that there should be greater public awareness and public dissemination of the findings, that the provision should there be a review on any legislation, that there should be own accord reporting in addition to the mandatory reporting, compulsory education campaigns both at a prison level as well as just the general public level, and that there should be regular reports and feedback to the SHRC, which is stated within the legislation and not just institutionally. The SHRC has also, as I mentioned, regularly requested that we accompany the JICs on their visits to correctional centres, but this should maybe be a more fixed relationship. Perhaps we could explore, and I'm sure the Chair would speak more to that, the drafting of an MOU. In the early days, there was talk around that, but again, there's been no development since. Let's just skip. I think there's been a lot of talk this morning also around the ICCVs, and it would be remiss of us not to also mention the ratification of the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture, which we have briefed this committee on previously. As a judicial inspector, we feel that the institution should be in a position to be both reactive and proactive to and allow for a better response mechanism, and this could possibly be done through the establishment of a national preventive mechanism under the OPCAT. We are not dictating what that model must be at this stage. Again, the chair can speak to those issues. But that there is a definite need in this country to explore a monitoring mechanism in line with our international and, in fact, regional human rights obligations. So we again reiterate the need for the government to ratify the OPCAT and create a mechanism or the NPM which encompasses the mandate of the CHICS as well as other oversight bodies in South Africa. I will leave it at that and hand over to our chair to make any additional inputs. Thank you.
Chairperson.
Thank you.
As instructed, can we proceed?
Thank you. I'll just make two or three comments. Firstly, with regards to the membership of the judge of our Section 11 committee. Section 11 committee is a committee which the Act allows us to appoint to advise on specific sensitive matters where we don't have the expertise. Section 11 deals with matters of equality, and one of those matters is our monitoring of the Lindela Center where people are held before they are deported. So he sits in that one, and we thought he does have a lot of knowledge and information with regards to matters of equality. And we think we can build on that to formulate a memorandum of understanding between the two institutions, because there is a lot of overlap. I remember last year when I visited Portsmouth. There was a lot of things, our observations there, that place need a lot to be done in terms of the conditions of the prisoners in that one. So I think we will really recommend strongly that we move forward and sign a memorandum of understanding. And we, as a commission, feel it our responsibility to more frequently visit places of detention. Unfortunately, we don't have the capacity. Our staffing is so small, bearing in mind the number of prisons in the countries, places of detention, in the police station, and now we have got Lindela. We must also inform this committee that in terms of our preparation to be appointed as a monetary mechanism, we are in advance and we have already drafted a budget which we have submitted to the Department of Justice. That is the monitoring in terms of OPCAT, which will enable us to be more present in places of detentions. I think just by way of information, we'll stop there and wait for the questions. Thank you.
Advocate Lufan. I read a document by Advocate Amaya Mia. I don't know if you have seen that document, which suggests that less than 40% of the people of South Africa have read the Constitution or know anything about the Constitution. Now, my view is that a constitutional state such as ours, having a Bill of Rights, presupposes that there should be a devoted program of human rights education. And we have many institutions, Chapter 9 institutions, supporting democracy. But I really haven't had a report of
the amount of work, if any, that is being done to educate the people about these rights. And if you look around, the tendency in South Africa now is that freedom means taking the law into our hands and, where necessary, also destroying private and public property to enforce our rights. And can we still talk of ourselves as a constitutional state if such things happen? Do these things happen because of our failure to educate the public about human and people's rights? And if that is the case, shouldn't we also be talking as to how are we going to address this question? Because I think it's reaching crisis situation. Right now, the students are damaging property. At one university, the students are divided. The others say people must go to class. Others say no. Then you are going to have a civil war amongst the students. Now, what will be left of the Constitution if this type of situation continues? I raise this thing because you are talking about monitoring. I think monitoring alone cannot be adequate. You know, I'm aware that your committee did investigate racism at universities, and now investigate questions of xenophobia in the case of the King of the Zulus. And now there's a question of so-called racism at Pretoria Girls High. Now the question is, those people at Pretoria Girls High, how much do they know about the Bill of Rights, religious rights of people? And then the department sets up a commission of inquiry to investigate racism, and the finding may be that these people don't even understand the Constitution, don't even know that their rights belong to other people. Now, I am also saying, therefore, isn't education where we should be studying, have a national program of human rights education, and assign roles for all Chapter 9 institutions and NGOs just to educate the nation? Otherwise, we will be applying a constitution, a modern constitution, to a rural people who know nothing about that. And at the end, it may, in my view, delegitimize the entire constitutional system. But again, I think it would be unrealistic to expect that the Chapter 9 institutions alone and NGOs can be adequate to the task. You know, there is a developed advice center movement in the country. We agreed that we'll pass paralegal legislation, but from the organized legal profession and others, there doesn't seem to be keenness to have that, even from the department, to have that legislation passed, because advice centers are in the informal settlement in the townships. They can fulfill a major role even in terms of education. And yourselves could produce educational materials, translate these materials into the various languages, and let these advice centers go and teach the population. So I really want to suggest that we can't continue to pretend that we live in a constitutional state and that the people understand what that means and what this human rights tradition means. So we need to really address that question. Lastly, you know, I see some today, people say, we're going to deal ruthlessly with Ukutwala. Where is the investigating capacity to go and go into families and find out who was trialed and who was not trialed? when the serious matters are there, we can't even deal with them. I was in one big meeting in Natal where ordinary women from the rural areas say the Constitution did not give birth to children. We're going to do to our children what we, our culture allows us to do. They're referring to this virginity testing. So you can't blame these people for thinking that way. We have not even taught them and told them why we say things must be done differently. Now, in short, I'm saying that let's not treat our people as objects and consumers of some modern system somewhere. We must educate them, let them know that we are living in a new environment, new society, so that when we punish them, we must punish them because they have intentionally violated the law. Thank you very much. That's just my remarks, and I don't expect you to answer all those things. I'm just saying it's food for thought. Thank you.
Just a short response, Chair. Thank you for the comments you have made. And maybe, you know, just to add to what you have said, recently our commission investigated a matter of corporal punishment and made a finding against a particular church in KZN. And when we made a finding, and then they were appealing against that finding, then we also got a complaint from a Chapter 9 institution questioning why did we make such a finding of corporal punishment, because in terms of religion or in terms of religious practices, it is okay to do what that was done. It's a Chapter 9 institution. The CGE, the Commission on Gender Equality, conducted an investigation in terms of virginity testing. It made a finding against that. They got a complaint from a Chapter 9 to say, why do you make such a finding? I'm saying this to indicate, you know, the problem that sometimes we are finding, and sometimes we think that the people who are doing all of these things don't know the Constitution. So I just wanted you to also bear in mind that it is not always so that what we see happen is because people don't know the Constitution. We as a commission belong, have partnered with the NOYA Constitution, you know, NGO, working around, moving in the throughout the country to disseminate the Constitution, to do our best, small as we are, together with the Department of Justice, we are moving around. But I share your sentiments and I share your complaints. We are asking ourselves the same question, to say, look, these things that we see happen, is it because the people don't know the Constitution? We conducted an investigation recently on the protest that happened in Vuani. We have just released a report to try and find out exactly what are the issues under, what are the underlying issues. I think it's a bigger problem maybe which we would want to discuss with you, and the Honorable Judge will know that in our first meeting, following on the conference on racism that we held this year, we are working out a strategy to move forward precisely because you have raised, Chairperson, and maybe we'll brief you at an appropriate time. I see we already have a date that will be appearing before you, although I'm not sure how many of commissioners will be there, because by the end of this month we are likely to have only one commissioner. But I think it's a very important question that we are raising, and sometimes we believe we have spoken to the people. For instance, when people kill the LGBTI people, you ask yourself whether when we passed that legislation, did the people understand what was happening there? So those are very difficult questions, and I wouldn't want to go deeper into that, but I take your challenge. That is a challenge that we'll sit down and try to answer those questions and share our thoughts around them. There is a lot that we are doing. I'm sure in a week's time we'll also be releasing a report around the investigation on the King and the transformation. So we will share those reports with you. I think I'll stop here for now. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we would be interested in having a report on Vuali, but also to ask ourselves, before even the establishment of the apartheid state, the Tsonga and Venda people in that area lived together, and they never had a civil war among themselves. Why is it that when we are in a democratic dispensation with a policy of unity and diversity, when we want to build a socially cohesive society, then we have decisions which make people who never fought among themselves start fighting? So I want to agree with you. The situation may be much deeper, but I think we must look at ourselves as government and these institutions, because those people are the same people. They have intermarried. They have lived together for many years. Why are they fighting now? I'm happy that you are dealing with that matter, because it's very, very disturbing. Because each time we think we're going forward, then we're moving, taking two steps backward.
No, thanks, Chairperson. And thanks to the Human Rights Commission for the presentation. Although, Chairperson, there seems to be similarities between this presentation and others, but you get a sense that the presentation says comes after your work, Chairperson, which says there appears that we are working in silos. The presentation says there could be partnerships between the Human Rights Commission and JICS. But it also says the matter of capacity for both establishments should be looked into so that we can come up with a better product. So I'm saying there's no need to come up with quick decisions here. We need to be cool, reflect, discuss these issues, and come up with what is best for the country. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I think
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to support what Honorable Maila is actually putting forward, to say that the presentation of the South African Human Rights Commission actually says maybe partnership with JICS is what could actually cure some of the problems that have actually been put forward. Because like I said earlier, we have institutions already that we've set up. And we shouldn't actually behave towards those institutions as if we do not actually believe in them. If it's about a matter of capacity, we need to look at what to do with the capacity. Because quite evidently, presentation of the South African Human Rights Commission says that they are actually also doing the work. They lack capacity. So we need to start looking at capacity issues. Similarly to capacity issues within JICS, you know, to do away with the situation where you find that the ICC Vs have got to work in the offices of the of DCS and have email addresses of DCS, and that we actually do also to deal with the public perception. Because sometimes if we work on assumptions only, we can actually end up coming up with creative
ways of thinking in a way that doesn't actually help us to manage to deal with what are real issues. So basically, I think at the end of the day, what needs to happen is just to look at the partnerships, and then the South African Human Rights Commission is actually also suggesting that maybe there should be a memorandum of understanding to create that relationship, which would be something that could quickly deal with this. But at the end of the day, we must actually underline capacity. Because as long as we're not going to deal with capacity issues, we're going to find ourselves still where we are today. And then in terms of appointment, you made mention of something about appointment of the inspecting judge. I would like to have some clarity as to what you actually referring to, so that we note it as the committee. Because you said the appointment of the inspecting judge is not similar to the appointment of the other chapter 9 institution heads, and if you can just clarify so that we note it, and it may be something that needs to be looked at moving forward. The chairperson has alluded to the fact that maybe the area also that still needs, that's still wanting, is the area of human rights awareness. And then the response says we have actually done a lot of work in terms of really bringing about human rights awareness among South Africans, but quite evidently what you see around you are problems. And indeed, I think maybe people have actually been educated about their rights. Our people today have got a voice that they used not to have during the apartheid era. Our people have managed to regain their dignity, because that voice comes with how you feel about yourself, how you assert yourself. And that our people have got. And I think in that respect, you can actually say maybe awareness of rights has actually, and maybe having also a democratic dispensation has, and that maybe it's a sign of liberation. The voice is there. But it's quite evidently now what you see, which becomes almost chaos, says what else needs to be done? Because what you hear now is demands and demands and demands that are based on rights. But at the same time, maybe we need to do some other different type of awareness. Because, you know, it's like when you have a family and you've got resources and children are making demands, everybody needs to understand to what extent it's possible for South Africa to do whatever needs to be done, whatever is being demanded, so that we demand in a way that is actually not going to create chaos. We demand in a way that's going to actually help South Africa to move forward. Thank you, Chairperson.
You are right that people regain dignity. But, you know, it's disturbing that you have a situation where one Chapter 9 institution challenging another one for doing its work, which may mean that even the understanding of this human rights culture between themselves is not the same. But also, you can't have a society that only believes in the rights and no responsibilities. You know, if I drive into a township and there is unrest, and why should somebody destroy my car and attack me in the exercise of their rights? So what type of understanding would that be? So I think we should agree, Advocate Mishwan, that there's something much deeper that we need to look into and address. But I see Honorable Horn wants to say something before we move on.
Yeah, Chair, the one thing I would maybe would like a comment, but also when the judge or the judicial inspectorate gets their turn just after this, which I found quite interesting, was the contemplated electronic link between the Human Rights Commission and the inspecting judge in terms of maybe the one being able to monitor the other, or to put it bluntly, work together. And I got the impression from the Human Rights Commission presentation that that really have not ever come off the ground properly. So I would like to know, if so, why and whether there's still a possibility to make this work, because I think such a thing can add value. Thank you.
Can we leave the Human Rights Commission there? We are going to deal with the we will get the acting CEO, Mr. Masondo, to present on behalf of JICS. And after that presentation, we will ask the judge to share with us for 10 or so minutes about his vision. And we will understand that is a preliminary presentation on his vision. I guess he will want to digest what he has found in the office and what is being said, and then come back possibly at the January meeting with his final vision and mission, so he can assist us to move forward. So if that is acceptable, Judge, I will ask the CEO, acting CEO, to address us.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honorable members and colleagues in the House. I will try to move as fast as possible because I have to create time for the judge to be able to address us too.
Excuse. The judge is entitled to his own time.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's all right. All right. The House have mentioned, so that the Honorable Mocheke, the Honorable Mocheke referred to the partnership, for that we should have with these other stakeholders. I just want to mention that, yes, we are in partnership with the Human Rights Commission in relation to the inspections. There are some few inspections that we have done with them, and also the Public Service Commission. There are some inspections that we have conducted with them, and also we conducted some inspections with judges like Judge Cameron and Judge Ampembe. Okay, my presentation, colleagues, it will be on the purpose of our office and the impact of our office. I am not going to dwell much on the issue of the legal mandate because I am harboring under the impression that you know now about our mandate. And I will go straight to the issue of post-establishment of our office. And also to state that with the assistance of the current judge, we managed so far since 2012, after the establishment of our new structure, that we managed to secure the 42 positions, even though we are given 24 to advertise. And currently, we are at the process of filling these 24 positions. And the remaining 18 out of this 42, we still have to negotiate with department in terms of them abolishing their positions so that they can also transfer them to us. These are the things that are sort of are binding our hands because we can't advertise the whole of this 42 before the department can abolish the positions that they are having, and then after, then they have to transfer them to us. And another thing that I want to cite here is the issue of the ICCV, that the appointment conditions differs from that of the permanent staff. The ICCVs are appointed as independent contractors with a specific period of 3 years. then upon the expiry of that 3 years, then it's either they reapply or else they go somewhere. Of course, in most cases, that because of the condition, we are having a problem of filling all the vacant positions of ICCV because of, as I've said also yesterday, that the employment conditions, they are not on permanent and not and are working on specific hours. So as Honorable Mutapo yesterday said, they even source work outside to have double work to compensate on what they are getting. And also to talk on the issue of the current positions that we are having. We are having 43 permanent posts and one vacant post, which is the post of an called CEO. Then out of these 43 positions, I guess I can just cite example of only two whereby these people are doubling up. For example, the inspectors. The inspectors are doubling up as investigators. We only have four inspectors, and out of these four inspectors, three are on contract, and only one, which is permanent. And these four inspectors are supposed to do inspections and investigations nationally. And seriously, it's too it's called exhausting for them. And also on the issue of our trainers and the community liaison, they're also doubling up. It's one person doing the work of the community liaison and also the work of being a trainer. Then when you come to the budget of 2016-2017, of course, I guess it will suffice to state also that with the assistance of the current justice, we managed to speak with Treasury in terms of them ring fencing our budget, so that if they have allocated a budget to us, then it won't be touched. And currently, in 2016-2017, the total budget that we're having is 65 million, then 309,000. Then on compensation, that deals with the payment of staff, we are at 57,380,000. Then on goods and services, it's 7,929,000. Then expenditure to date, what we have spent up until now, it's 17,973,275. Then in terms of our strategic objective, is as follows: to provide effective independent oversight relating to the treatment of inmate and the condition in correctional centers and triple P's, which is a private, what's called private prisons. Then we have a strategic indicator, which is the percentage of correctional facilities and triple P's inspected on the conditions and treatment on inmates. As I have stated earlier, that with the capacity that we are having, we then put the target for us so that we'll be able to inspect this prison. Then nationally, we have 243 prisons. Then if I can go back a little bit, in 2013-2014, our target was 93 that we have inspected out of these prisons. Then and in 2014-2015, it was 91. Then in 2015-2016, it's 81. And also in 2016-2017, it's 81. Then in 2018 is going to be 162. Then we envisage that by the year 2018-2019, probably we'll be capacitated and be able to inspect all the prisons, like it's called, every year, starting from that year. Then when we come to the investigations and inspections, a total of 13 investigations and 81 inspections were conducted by us in 2015-2016. The main allegations from investigations, that assaults and sexual assaults on inmates on inmate. Then we have assaults on officials on inmates, then assault
in terms of the EST, which is Emergency Support Team officials, on inmates and allegation of confiscation and destruction of property of inmates. Then we have alleged homicide, that's officials on inmate. Then the main findings from our inspections, but overcrowding, issues around safe custody, violation of inmates' rights, deteriorating infrastructure, poor treatment of inmates relating to exercise, nutrition, rehabilitation programs, and health care. Shortages or shortage of DCS officials, especially on health care professionals. Then when you come to the issue of the mandate, or mandatory reporting, in terms of the provisions of the Correctional Services Act, DCS is supposed to report on us on the following, that is Section 15 on death, and Section 30 on segregation, and Section 31 on mechanical restraint, and Section 32 on use of force. During the 2015-2016, the following mandatory reporting included 619 reports on use of force, 573 reports on death, which is 511 on natural death, and 62 on unnatural death. Then 315 reports on the use of mechanical restraints, and 12,678 reports on segregation. Then when you come to the complaints management system, the table that you see under the complaint management system is self-explanatory. But if you can quickly zoom in terms of the higher complaints that we are dealing with in this 2015-2016, it was on complaints on health and complaints on legal representatives and also transfers. Then when you go to the stakeholders' engagement, the ICCVs under the management of JICS regional offices are involved with several stakeholders to assist inmates with various with various initiatives, which includes forming relationship with consulates to assist with complaints from foreign national inmates, transfer of state patients, child or youth in conflict with the law, workshop on torture and the violation of human rights of inmates. ICCV pilot or training on sexual assault, participating in the finalization of SAPS cases, referring cases to legal aid, campaign against gangsterism, education about crime, and plea bargaining. Then when we go to the achievements by our office, as I have stated earlier, that we managed to get 42 positions since we did not have this position in 2012 up until now. And also we have managed to ring-fence our budget, and the formal opening of regional office, we are going to open two regional offices in Bloemfontein and in Durban. Of course, you are invited. Then a mention was made in length in terms of the proposed amendment in relation to the Act. We have submitted our proposed amendment, and DCS have allocated Paxton, Mr. Paxton, in terms of the amending the Act. And of course, I guess the inputs in relation to that, of course, probably they will be given to him too. Then a proposal for the new organizational form for the inspectorate. We have touched base with few organization in terms of checking what type of organizational form JICS should take. We went to the Treasury for the advice in that regard, and also we spoke with the Office of Tax Ombudsman, and also not forgetting that there were some previous submission in that regard. Then we touched base with the Office of Government Communication and Information System in relation of the corporate identity, because we were told that the way we are using the logo it's wrong, and we can be criminalized for a sentence of less than 3 years. So now we are at the process of trying to create our own corporate identity. Then in terms of the short terms, as the chairperson requested yesterday, the short term to finalize the organizational form that we should adopt by the 30 September 2016, we also benchmark with IPED, as I've said, and also the Office of Ombudsman. We also met with Treasury. We met with government communication, as I've mentioned, and the finalization or the finalizing the relocation of office from Cape Town to Pretoria. The deadline is 31 December 2015, because we have realized that operationally, we will operate much better if we are in Pretoria than here, because in most cases we have meetings with the department, and we fly time and again, and so it's costly. And also we have to address the staff who are affected with this type of relocation. Because in our mind is that as we are moving the office of George to Cape Town, and that office is going to be a regional office. So for those who can't relocate to Pretoria, then they will form part of the regional office here. There won't be any loss of job, any grading or whatsoever. Oh, sorry. My apologies. My apologies. I don't know whether did you hear what I've been saying. Can I go back? Okay. Okay, also the finalization of the 22 positions that we have advertised, that we'll do by the 1st of October, oh, sorry, of November, 1st of November. Currently, the staff is busy with interviews, and also the remaining 18, we envisage that before the end of this year, we should be able to have appointed on the whole of 42 positions. And also the opening of the other office, as I have said, the Office of George, which is servicing Western Cape, will come here, and the others that we will be servicing Eastern Cape will be in the East London office. That's where we are going to open that office, and it will be on the 31st December 2016. Then the medium term, can I drink? Okay. The medium term plan, a review of the services of the service delivery model and the structure, and the structure of the deadline is 31 March 2017. Legislative amendment to maximize the effectiveness of JICS, the deadline is 31 March 2017. Development of a strategic plan and an annual performance plan for JICS, that is 31 March 2017. Review of the ICCV appointment policy to investigate the feasibility of permanent employment of ICCV, that will be on 31 March 2017. Then the long term, JICS to be a separate entity from DCF, JICS to align and expand to all six regions, and in the future to have presence in all the nine provinces. To have finalized the legislative amendment and to have a binding recommendations, as it was said earlier with some of the colleagues. Implementation of the strategic plan objectives. That's so far that my presentation will go. Thank you very much.
Our civil society friends must be happy now. You can see that JICS has not been sitting, folding arms. They've actually moved faster. You hear that
that after the appointment of Judge Van der Westhuizen, already steps were taken to make sure that the finances reinvest, that they do independent oversight, that maybe some of our fears is because if we don't communicate and then we don't know that progress is being made elsewhere. But this report is very encouraging. It shows that there is movement. There is movement. And then we will just allow the judge now to rule.
Thank you very much, Chair. It is an honor to be here. I'm always very appreciative of the generous introductions that Dr. Motshekga always do. When I'm appearing somewhere, I appreciate it. I spent many all nights in the passages of this building at the time of the constitution drafting, and at the moment I cannot even remember where the toilets are, so that just shows you what age does. The chair mentioned the unity and diversity of our nation. I think it is in that context that Ms. Padayaki is called Ms. Pillay. She can be lucky that she is not called Ms. Naidu. But in order to put that in context, when an academic, a social commentator, a person who has great confidence in his own insights, wrote a discussion of a judgment of the Constitutional Court when I was still on the court, he wrote, amongst other things, that the real pearls of wisdom in this judgment comes from the judgment by Justice Van der Westhuizen. But then he continued to refer to Justice Van der Westhuizen as Justice Van der Merwe in the same article. No, it was... So we all have our stereotypes. I think I was expecting that in this meeting perhaps people would refer to the chair instead of Dr. Motshekga, maybe as Dr. Malema, but so far that has not happened. A brief note, and I'm not going to give a final opinion, but the debate about reformation, transformation, etc., yes, it is correct, as the chair said, in the struggle time, reformation referred to keeping the system but making changes to it, whereas transformation referred to a totally new beginning. But I have some news for all of us. All of these terms are to some extent in disrepute at the moment. Over the past few months, I have had the benefit or... Yeah, it is a mixed blessing to be close to some of the student events, the student protests on campuses, and as well as the academic debate around it. And in some circles, transformation is as bad a term as, and prepare for the shock if you don't already know it, as it is to quote Mr. Nelson Mandela. In some circles, when one quotes Mandela, it is a sellout signal of a fake national unity and rainbow nation kind of concept. Terms like decolonization are preferred above transformation, and these by students who refer to themselves as the revolutionary core of the university or the revolutionary backbone of the university. And although I'm saying this tongue-in-cheek, I think I have developed a genuine concern that all of us in this parliament, in the courts, in leadership positions, do not fully understand and appreciate what is going on that level. And I know it is not the job of this committee, but if parliament ever looks at that, I think one must, I could advise, but let's talk, because I've been close to people who call themselves hardline revolutionaries, but once they see that somebody is prepared to listen to them, they carry my bags to the car and ask my advice on the next protest. But there are serious concerns about what is going on the ground. I thank Mr. Masondo and our team, Mr. Mushwana there at the end, who's in charge of finances, Ms. Naidu, who is our head of research, and Mr. Umesh Raga, who is the head of the legal department, for the presentation. I do not have all those facts and figures. I was appointed in the beginning of April. The appointment came into being, but I was notified of it only much later, and therefore I'm still learning. Of course, I understand that one cannot learn for too long, especially when an appointment is one for 3 years. Let me tell you what I found when I met with the JICS staff for the first time. I suppose it was in May. Firstly, many colleagues of mine said this job is somebody here mentioned that it seems dry and technical. Some of my colleagues said this is a very boring job and not glamorous compared to teaching at Oxford and those kinds of things. I found, however, that it could be an extremely exciting project and an extremely exciting challenge. What I found, as far as staff members are concerned, is a staff very committed to our task regarding the human rights of inmates, but to some extent very discouraged by the response from the department, from DCS, very frustrated, and to a considerable extent quite suspicious that every obstacle that we experienced administratively was to some extent perceived as a deliberate attempt to undermine our capacity and our independence. I personally don't always think in terms of conspiracy theories, but I was then told by people in very high political positions that this is not necessarily an unfounded suspicion. I thought it simply had to do with red tape, etc. The staff have been particularly discouraged and frustrated by a lack of response from DCS, and linked to that, the fact that our recommendations are not binding, that we do not have a way of enforcing it. Furthermore, I found an organization with many vacancies and positions, with many people appointed on contract, where their contracts would expire in a week or two, and they still don't know what the future is. And I found some internal dissent amongst staff members, especially in the head office in Cape Town, limited levels of discontent, partly perhaps resulting from the events around the previous CEO and the lack of a judge for a considerable time. The acting CEO, Mr. Masondo, has done much to address these issues, but some of them are still there. We also have had issues with office space. For example, in Centurion in Gauteng, the office is wholly unsuitable for what we are supposed to do, and I won't deal with you talk to you in detail about that. Legislative amendments. I'm avoiding now transformation and reform and all of that. Amendments to the legislation are seriously necessary. Mr. Masondo explained what is going on, but just from my perspective, a few months ago, I was called by a very senior official in the department, whose calls I normally, to some extent, am not happy to receive. But I was told that I must be present. I was asked about times. I was told I must be present when this is going to be discussed, and then I never heard from them again. We would be happy to look into Mr. Swart's proposals, but especially to join your effort here in Parliament if there is an event in January. Something about complaints, and this has nothing to do with facts and figures. We receive complaints in different ways, sometimes on the ground from the family members of an inmate. We also receive sort of high-profile complaints that come through some of my former colleagues and come from university professors, etc. One thing that one must keep in mind, just on my own limited experience, is that a complaint must be relatively detailed for us to be able to do something about it. If we receive a complaint simply referring to inhumane conditions, a word that I don't easily use, cells that are underground, showers that people who get one shower a week or something, and we send a detailed report with an aerial photograph to show that there are no cells underground. And then the response from the particular complainant, who they say that they have clients in that particular facility. But then they, and then we ask them, if we say we can investigate more if we know who you're talking about. Then they say no, they don't want to disclose the names for, out of fear of retribution. Now, that may be a legitimate fear, and therefore I would ask our colleagues in the NGO community to help us to find a way to address that, because it is very difficult if all the information we have is that the most of the points raised in the complaint, apart from vague terms like inhumane conditions and so on, do not necessarily accord with our information, and we don't know who it is who complained in the first place. Having said that, of course, even on the general level of inhumane conditions, we do take it seriously. Some of the maximum or super maximum security measures are a matter of concern, which we are looking into, bearing in mind at the same time the need for security. The Human Rights Commission, as mentioned, I'm on their Section 11 committee. That is just me in person. Three things there. Firstly, at our first meeting, chaired by Advocate Mushwana, I was overwhelmed by how massive the task of the Human Rights Commission is. It is also a very massive mandate where it is very difficult, although they have different departments, different sections, etc., but it is difficult to prioritize and see what is the most urgent, and because one runs the risk that you try to do everything at the same time and nothing gets done. Completely outside my mandate, speaking for JICS here, is I would ask Parliament to please appoint human rights commissioners, because as Advocate Mushwana said, they will be left with one commissioner soon. Regarding the electronic link, I'm illiterate with these things, so I have no response. I assume my colleagues will have. As far as the memorandum of understanding is concerned, let's talk about it and let's draft something. I will be awaiting the first draft. Short-term, medium, long-term, I think one must clearly distinguish and not mix them up. I don't want to talk here about strategic objectives and all of that. I think the long-term goal is that we will be a crime-free society. But I have some doubts as to whether this will be achieved very quickly. So in the meantime, we have to address the realities of our society as it is at the moment, which include grossly overcrowded prisons and allegations of or realities of gang warfare, abuse by wardens, torture by officials, and sometimes very serious assaults. And I will come back to that in a minute. We are at the moment, one of the things we have been doing, but which we've been emphasizing since my appointment, is we are looking at international best practices, but also worst practices and medium practices, if I can call it that way. We don't want to just go on a gravy train trip to countries without knowing what we are looking for, so we are doing research here first, and then perhaps later we will go. We will go to African societies, we will look at them. Some are good, some are very bad. I don't even know whether one will get access to some of these places. We will look at Latin America if necessary. From what we see on television, there's a lot to look at there. Perhaps Asia, and we will look at Europe also. Although, I'm not sure that we can really compare ourselves to Norway or the Netherlands, where they actually close down prisons because they do not have enough criminals, and therefore the correctional officials are left unemployed. A long-term game is unemployment for all the correctional services officials. One of the things that we've started doing now, as you know, all judges are supposed to inspect prisons. At the Constitutional Court a few years ago, we started this practice encouraging at least Constitutional Court judges. I was at Paulsmuir, for example, a few days before my term on the court expired, And I did not even, although I knew that this job was vacant, I did not even think of it at the time. In fact, when I was told that people like Mr. George Havel Thomas and other gang leaders have positions in their gangs for generals and judges and so on, I was considering to apply there. But then the minister called me from Tanzania to ask if I would be prepared to do this. What I would like to do is to coordinate with the other judges. It seems to me that judges in the High Court are not really involved in it, although I thought so while I was in the Constitutional Court. But what we are planning now is when we visit centers like Bloemfontein, for example, or Durban, that we will have some event with judges in that area to coordinate. And our purpose is, I think, JICS, as far as I understand from my colleagues, can realistically only inspect a facility once in 3 years. What we would like to do is to encourage judges not to go to the place nearest to their holiday home or their farm, but to specifically go to places that we do not see regularly. It does not always have to be a full-scale inspection. Even if it is just a visit of a few hours, we think it would help. So we are working on a way to coordinate that. When we have the Bloemfontein event, we plan to have a small cocktail reception with the judges from the SEA and from the Free State to start that. As to enforceability, yes, I hear everything that everyone said, and I welcome it in terms of strengthening JICS. But let me also say that we must put the, what is the English expression, the ant in a bosom state. We must introspect also. Although legislative changes are really necessary, there is a lot that we can do even within the present framework. And a lack of energy and a lack of commitment cannot always be blamed on the legislature or the minister or whoever. First of all, we have decided, and I strongly insist, that we must have a higher public profile, that we must be more active, both in response to complaints, but also proactively. When we had a strategic session, my colleagues listed as one of our main challenges the fact that the public don't like criminals. The public simply say that why must we look after the rights of these people, etc. We know the refrain. They have given up their rights. They are criminals. Why must we spend money on them? There is little sympathy. So what we need is a higher profile, not only to attract attention sensationally, but also simply to educate the public. Our annual report will be published soon. This report I have actually had nothing to do with because it contains information from before I was appointed, but you may see that we are trying, or not right now, perhaps a little bit now, but we will try to make our material more reader-friendly. Whether that is possible, I don't know, but I have closet desires to be a famous writer after my court years. So my view is that an annual report that says so-and-so annual report for the years, this and this and this, on a coffee table is not the most attractive piece of reading that one could put up while you're waiting for your doctor or for your dentist. But if there is something more appetizing, you may have a look at it. So we have actually said, and this we're coming close to a more controversial part, when my staff members said, but what can we do if the department simply don't respond, I said, well, then we will go to the media and we will embarrass them in public. But we must be fair. Now, let me tell you that the minister and the deputy minister, as far as I'm concerned, in my meetings with them, fully agree with that. I was very pleasantly surprised, if I may say, with the support from both the minister and especially the deputy minister, who focuses more, that both of them actually said, and the deputy minister said it before I proposed it, that we must have a higher profile, the public must know more about what we are doing. I suggested this option, that we will go to the media when necessary, but I, of course, added that we will do it in a fair and responsible way, and that is what we agreed on. In other words, we are not going to surprise anybody with a Friday evening television video of some horrible event. I saw the National Commissioner on Monday. It was basically a courtesy visit, and I found the National Commissioner to be very open to this as well. When I mentioned one example to him, which I will mention now, he simply requested that we send him the material. He did not say, do not have your event or whatever. Before I get to that one, the Bloemfontein and Durban offices have been mentioned. What we are planning with regard to Bloemfontein in the first week of November is not only to have an office party, but to have a seminar. We have tentatively chosen as a topic overcrowding. That is a topic that JICS and the department and all my colleagues behind us are probably very tired with. There are perhaps more dynamic new topics, but it is something that we think and that I think personally the public know very little about. And I think if they know that in a cell, like I've experienced personally, that in a cell in Polsmoor, a cell built for 18 to 20 people, there are 96 people living in that cell, sleeping there, then there will be a lot more understanding for the difficulties the department is facing, the job that JICS is doing, and for and what our society in general is doing. Just before I move on to the last example, the national the logo was mentioned. I wasn't aware that it is a criminal offence if we use the coat of arms of our country. When I was at the Constitutional Court, my card had the coat of arms of the country on the one side and the court logo on the other side, because I think we all should be proud of the state of which we are a part. So we will investigate that, but what is clear is that we do need our own logo and our own corporate identity. We'll get there. The example that I want to mention, and here we have to be careful because I don't want to run ahead of things. Talking about no response to complaints, talking about the media, etc. In August, I became aware of events that took place at a facility in January 2015 already, with a very graphic video, which, if it goes viral, will... One can either make a lot of money out of it, but the result may be that no country will ever extradite anybody to South Africa to be put, because the video, amongst other things, show dogs dragging a person out of a cell, an ongoing assault on that person who then died 2 or 3 days later. I was shocked to see this, and then I was informed in detail by our staff how they have been calling for reports on this from the department for more than a year and a half, a year and 8 months or so, with repeated promises from the department that the report is almost ready. I insisted that we write a letter to them, which we did. The letter went to everybody, from the head of the institution, area commissioner, regional commissioner, deputy commissioner, deputy national commissioner, acting national commissioner, commissioner, deputy minister. And we gave them about a week, and we said if we do not receive the report by the end of August, we will have a media conference the next week. So they immediately, on the level of the regional commissioner, by the way, yesterday, Monday, when I met the national commissioner, he was not aware of any of this. So I do not know what happened to my to the letter that was supposed to him, the email. But very quickly, the regional commissioner presented a very thick report, through which Mr. Raga and his colleagues and others have been working, with a recommendation that, by the way, let me just say, this is not just an assault. This is a prima facie evidence of murder, nothing short of that. With the surprising conclusion, if I'm correct, that no steps have been taken against these officials, except that they were transferred somewhere else. The National Prosecuting Authority and police decided, or I don't know whether the decision is not to prosecute or have not yet decided. If I remember correctly, the conclusion of the report is that they should not be disciplined because they work under difficult circumstances. And then we asked for the The report referred to certain attachments. Mr. Raga asked for the attachments to be sent to us, which we have not received by the date we posed. So actually, during today and tomorrow, we will decide what to do. But what I told the regional commissioner specifically asked to come to see me in private. And the first half the first half of our meeting, he made all the recommendations that we heard from the NGO community here, namely how we can be more powerful and more independent and how our positions must be more senior and so on. Before we even got to the report, I took into account all his advice, but then said, let's now talk about the report. And I mentioned to him that if we cannot reach an agreeable, acceptable agreement, or then we will have at that particular facility an event, a seminar based on the idea of the phenomenon of torture, and we will show the video, and they can come and present their case, and we will invite the NGO community and anybody else to comment on this. I mentioned this to the commissioner, who said we must just for the moment please send him the video, but he did not say stop or don't do it or whatever. He just asked to be properly informed. So that is the kind of stuff that we have been having with us. Next point, I have a personal interest in the human side of all of this. I am not too good with statistics and financial statements and so on. So on a number of occasions, I have met with inmates, some of those who are regarded as the most dangerous in the country. I've mentioned Mr. George Havel Thomas, who is in Kokstad, who is serving a 7 or 8 or 9 life sentences, who allegedly put out hit orders on the judge and all the witnesses. And we chatted for a while, and he enthusiastically agreed with my proposal that we write a book together. So I do have an interest in the human side, and I think as far as our approach is concerned, one must try to project something like that to the public. Like I said, not only, of course, the Constitution, the law, the human rights instruments, international law, all of that is the basis, but we must try to convey the message to the public of what we are dealing with here. And to be fair, to of course, the human rights of inmates who are vulnerable, but also the difficulties of the whole system. I've been visiting regional offices, and I'm not saying this to say how much I've done. What I do want to tell you is that in places like Bloemfontein and Durban, I have been met with tremendous enthusiasm and excitement by our staff there. I was in Bloemfontein yesterday. I almost missed my flight because they wanted to talk on an ongoing basis. They all seem to be looking for some kind of injection of energy and ideas and something to do, to go forward to. Relationship with DCS officials. Yeah, let me not actually talk about that. Let me just say one thing, because it applies to all of us. And it was not mentioned to me in the first place. You know, the judge is appointed for 3 years. The minister is there until the next cabinet reshuffle, and if that doesn't happen, until the next election. And the same, similarly, it applies to all of you, the minister. It is the impression of some of us, I won't say who, between the minister and myself and so on, that some of these senior officials know, are very aware of this, and they simply sit out the time. When we say this and that, whether it's the minister, whether it's the judge, whether it's perhaps this committee, I don't know, that this must immediately happen. They say we will start next week, and then nothing happens for until the next group comes in. The ministers have not all been, from what I understand, I did not work with previous ministers, but previous ministers have not all been as supportive of JICS as the present team, from what I understand. Last thing, independence. This is my last point. As has been pointed out, there are different levels of independence. First of all, JICS is, of course, not a court, so we cannot talk about the kind of independence that a court should have. And three kinds of different kinds of independence have been mentioned, but let's say institutional, administrative, financial, etc. We're looking at that. We discussed with Treasury recently a new status or whatever it's called of for JICS structure. Small note, Mr. Masondo mentioned the 42. This is actually quite disturbing. I think members of parliament would find it, this our positions that we advertised. When the minister did his budget speech, which I attended and some of us attended, he announced that JICS have had 42 new positions. Several parties congratulated the minister and said it's good news. When we afterwards said we're now going to advertise and fill those positions, we were told by the acting head of human resources at the department, together with the acting commissioner, national commissioner, that no, these are not new positions. That the department must now identify 42 posts that they must get rid of, and that they still need to identify which ones they can do about, but that it is very difficult to choose between a new PA for JICS, for the JICS judge, and an officer in the emergency support unit of which is kind of blackmail, because so we found it strange. We agreed in the interim with them. We were not even part of that decision as to which one, what is important and so on. We came to some agreement to advertise. I'm not sure if it was 24 or 28. We advertised them. We're busy filling them. Interviews are taking place. When I mentioned that to the minister, he was completely surprised. I said, but how can you say in Parliament we have 42 positions if we don't? And the minister said, but he also thought we had, because he was given that information by the department. Then we had a meeting with Treasury, and they held up financial statements and budgets and so on, which I did not understand at all. And they said, here it says that it is your 42 new positions, and not DCS has nothing to do with it. So when Mr. Raga mentioned that at a subsequent meeting to the department, the response was that you cannot talk about it because you were not present at the meeting. In any way, what we are going to do now, what we have drafted, we'll do it in the next day or two, is to write to them to simply say we are advertising these positions. Let us know in writing if you have an objection and exactly what your objection is, in which case we will then meet with Treasury and the minister and everybody all together at the same time. That is the first level of independence, financial, etc. The second level of independence is, of course, not to be influenced. As a judge, I can honestly say that I have never received a phone call from any politician, from the president, not even Dr. Mocheka. One day, a previous minister called me just to find out how I were a day or two before hearing an important case, but he didn't mention the case. He just wanted to know if I'm well and healthy. And so as far as I know, with regard to judges, or at least constitutional court judges, this does not happen. Here, of course, the situation is a bit difficult because we do have to work with the department. And to mention the example, the National Commissioner warmly extended an invitation that we should stay in touch and so on. Now, of course, that will make it on one level a little bit more difficult to embarrass them on television in front of the world. On the other hand, it will help, I suppose, to prevent those events by discussing it in time. The third level, and the most important one for me, of independence is the independence in one's own mind. And that I speak about with caution. At the court, I told my clerks, and I'm almost finished now, a few seconds. I told my clerks, I don't know who of you can know about the singer Chris Christopherson, who sang often about human rights and the down and out and so on. But in a song on his very late CD now, where he was at our house, at my house in Pretoria 2 years ago, he's now 80. But a song, one of his songs has the words, the song is called Don't Tell Me What to Do. The words are, gone are the reasons for changing my mind. Gone are the future that I left behind. You do not tell me what to do. Now, for a judge whose term expired, I said I do not like to be referred to as a retired judge. My term only expired, and then Deputy Minister Jeffrey said, "But to refer to you as an expired judge sounds even worse." But for an expired judge like myself, I really can assure you of my independence, and I think Dr. Mucheka and I will agree that I find it physically almost impossible to be intimidated by any other human being, except my wife maybe, but I'm scared of Rottweilers and snakes and ghosts and zombies and all of those things, but not of other people. However, having said that, I do appreciate that that does not necessarily apply to younger people who have a career ahead of them, who are worried about job security, who are worried about promotion possibilities, etc. And those things we must address as suggested. But for the moment, please be assured that as far as the judge is concerned, who knows? I don't know. When I was in the army, in the apartheid army many years ago, a captain gave us a long lecture on security and how not to be bribed by the communists and the Russians and so on. He said the guy who sits next to you and reading Bild in the bus is perhaps a Russian spy. And then he said, we must all be careful for bribes. He said, every man has his price. Mine is at least a bottle of brandy. So I'm not saying that one is a super being, but as far as I can humanly foresee, it will not be possible to intimidate or influence me. Of course, I will listen to all arguments, to arguments from all sides, to inputs, etc. That is where open-mindedness come in. But in the end, one has to take decisions based on the law and on your conscience. As far as our department is concerned, and JICS, and the independence and security of our staff members, I think, Chair, sorry for the long speech, but that is where all of you, behind me and in front of me, can come in to help us. Thank you very much.
Judge, I'm happy you disclosed that I never phone you to make any suggestions because I respect your independence and the ability to do things. Any comments, honorable members? If there are no comments, let us conclude our meeting. But I just want to say that the committee will summarize the recommendations that came out of here, especially with the legislative amendments that are desired. But it's good to hear from the judge and Mr. Masondo that already the department is doing something in that regard. But we are not going to allow them to set the pace. We will communicate with them, find out what they are doing. And if we don't think they are doing enough and fast enough, we will look at the proposal of Honorable Schwartz about a committee bill. But the issues before us are wide-ranging. We think that we should proceed with the idea of having this in Durban in January. And the committee secretary will coordinate a team, including the content advisor, Paul, who is here, and others, to put together a proposal informed by what has come out of here as to how we can go forward. But all that will be done in consultation with the Human Rights Commission, NICRO, and all other stakeholders, so that that endeavor must have clear objectives that we are all agreed on, and really say we want a program of action. And every stakeholder should know what their responsibilities are so that we must begin to implement. I think we have talked a lot, and then people even have a record of the meetings that agreed on things that never happened, and we cannot continue to have a situation like that. And especially that some of us
wants to retire, and we don't want to retire before we finish what we promised people we are going to do in this parliament. So I must thank you very much, all of you, especially the judge and his team, but also the civil society organization. I can see that you are very passionate about what you say and you want action. We won't let you down, and you have experienced people like Advocate Mshwane here who always advise us. So I think you are in good company with the judge and the advocate there, and these honorable members who never leave any stone unturned. So we are a good family, and thank you very much, Honorable Majaki.
Just for procedure, Chairperson, to say that the committee welcomes the report of the judge and has noted the contents.
I think that is very important to say and not be assumed like I did, and thank you for saying that. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
No, don't worry, they will do it.